Call the meeting to order. Representative Carlson. Sheldon Johnson, are you able to move the minutes?
I can move those today, yes, sir.
Thank you, sir. Any questions regards to the minutes? Seeing none, all in favor, say aye.
Aye.
Those opposed? Minutes approved. The chair will move that House File 1671 would be recommended to pass and go to the dark hole, the Finance Committee.
The Finance Committee, yes.
With that, Representative Carlson?
A favorable response over there, at least for a hearing.
I hope it goes well with the chair. I heard he's really something. Representative Carlson.
Okay, thank you. And members, House File 671 has four sections, and the first section of the bill requires an agency had to do payroll deduction of union dues or fair share for both unions when an employee belongs to two bargaining units. And what that's about, members, is there's a growing trend after the merger a few years ago of the state universities, community colleges, and technical colleges under the Minsky umbrella. And so you have growing numbers of faculty that might teach half-time at a state university and half-time at a community college. So currently, you can only have your dues deducted from one bargaining unit or the other, and what the request would be and what this bill would do would be allow both bargaining units to have the dues checked off. Second clause changes the amount of work an outside professional or technical contractor can perform without becoming part of the bargaining unit and covered by the collective bargaining contract. Currently, the limit is two consecutive quarters. And several years ago, we changed our state colleges and universities from a quarter system to a semester system, and so Section 2 of the bill reflects that change as well. So I would call that a bit of housekeeping, so it reflects that we are under the semester system. Section 2, Clause K, counts teaching service during the entire year for determining whether a part-time faculty member exceeds the three-credit threshold that makes them a member of the bargaining unit by defining when a year starts and stops. And it's my understanding that with growing numbers of people teaching summer sessions and so on, that change is needed. And Section 3 really does the same thing that Section 1 does, except that it covers fair share employees that would not be a full union member but would have deductions made as a result of their fair share status. With that, Mr. Chairman, that covers the bill, and I would point out that I do have people from the IFO here to answer any questions if there should be questions.
Thank you, Representative Carlson. I'm aware.
Sure if you want to take testimony, Mr. Chairman, or if you just want some available.
Well, I'm aware of about half an hour, 45 minutes worth of questions just on this bill, but I think members are probably willing to forego some of those.
That would be nice. Then while you're working, I'll have supper.
Let me ask. Wait a minute. Is there anyone that opposes the bill?
There is
some opposition to the bill. Before we, and come on down, we'd be happy to hear from you and we'll take questions. I do want to make sure that we've got the bill appropriately before us. We did have a committee report. The chair will move the committee report with respect to House File 1671. All in favor say aye.
Aye.
Any opposed? Seeing none, that motion prevails. And it's my understanding, Representative Carlson, that this is going to the back to finance, not to the general register. So the we'll amend the motion, the chair's motion, that it go to go to Finance Committee. Yes, sir, if you just provide your name and proceed with your testimony.
Chair, representatives, my name is Chris Dale. I'm with the Minnesota State Colleges and Universities. We object to the portion of the bill that would provide for the dual dues deductions for two different units simultaneously. The basis of our objection is essentially this, is that we believe the notice requirement, that is the Hudson notice that is provided to potential union members and fair share employees, is currently is configured under the BMS regulations is inadequate, doesn't comply with federal constitutional requirements as articulated by the Hudson Supreme Court case and the line of cases that came out of that case. Accordingly, because the notices are inadequate, the state, or Minsky in this particular case, faces some potential liability should we be sued. This is an expansion of that, and that's for that reason that we would object to the expansion at this time until those notice requirements can be brought into line with federal law.
Thank you.
And Mr. Chair, if you'd like, there's another point of view, and either Ms. Connie Howard, who's an attorney with the IFO, or Brett Stanton could comment. I think we'd prefer that the attorney, Ms. Howard.
That sounds great, Representative Carlson.
Thank you.
Welcome to the committee. If you just provide your name and proceed with your testimony.
Good morning, or good afternoon, I guess. My name is Connie Howard. I'm general counsel for the IFO. Minsky has been raising issues with regard to the adequacy of the fair share notice for years, and if they have a genuine issue with regard to the adequacy of the notice, the appropriate way of dealing with that would be to go to the underlying legislation and the BMS regulations. What we're talking about now is simply a collection mechanism, and what they are doing by opposing this is to make it essentially cost prohibitive for the unions who have folks in multiple bargaining units to collect the dues or fair share fees that they're owed. And if we can't collect them, what ends up happening is that the other folks in the unit end up paying more. So essentially what they're doing is encouraging a free rider sort of situation. And if there are issues with regard to the notice, we're more than glad to work with them on it, but this isn't the forum or the means to do that.
Thank you. Are there other questions or comments or anyone else who desires to be heard? Otherwise, Representative Lilly will renew his motion that House File 1671 be recommended passed and referred to the Committee on Finance. All in favor say aye.
Aye.
Any opposed?
No.
The motion prevails. Thank you, Representative Carlson.
Thank you, and thank you, members.
The Chair will move House File 1767. Representative Nelson's bill is actually first before us. Representative Davney is not here yet. The Chair will move the adoption of the committee report with respect to House File 1767. All in favor say aye.
Aye.
Any opposed? Seeing that motion prevails, Chair will move that House File 1767 be recommended passed and referred to the Committee on Finance with a recommended re-referral to the Committee on Higher Ed and Workforce Development. Representative Nelson to House File 1767.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Do you want the long version or the short version?
I think you know.
Anyway, House File 1767 has to do with, came from the department. We were been working with the Department of Labor and Industry. Last year we passed the misclassified worker bill, and as they're getting into this, they're finding that people are not filing for the exemption certificate. They're forming LLCs and S-Corp, and the numbers of those have tripled since the last couple of years, in December, January, and February of this year. And the department wants to be able to get at these people, a list of them, who they are, so they want to register them so that they can track who they are and make sure they can go after them, make sure that they are following the proper regulations as far as workers' comp and unemployment compensation.
Got it. Thank you, Representative Nelson. I had a chance to visit with the commissioner and the department folks as well, and it sounds like a good bill. Is there any opposition testimony to the bill? Any questions or concerns from members of the committee? If not, Chair will renew his motion that House File 1767 be recommended passed and referred to the Committee on Finance with a recommended re-referral to the Committee on Higher Ed and Workforce Development. All in favor say aye.
Aye.
Any opposed?
No.
The motion prevails. Next up is House File 1419. Is Representative Hillstrom available? Representative Hillstrom, welcome to the committee. The Chair will move House File 1419. And this, members, is a bill that will be laid over, is my understanding, for inclusion in another bill yet tomorrow, is my understanding. Something like that, Representative Hillstrom. But to your bill, and you'll explain it, and then we'll know what we're doing.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and members. This is a very short bill. It basically says that all state plumbing inspectors and plumbing inspectors contacted by the department should hold a license as a master journeyman or journeyman plumber and have 5 years of documented practical plumbing experience under this chapter. Members, this has been the case in the past. We just want to make sure that going forward that they actually are licensed, hold a license as a master or journeyman plumber. That's it, Mr. Chair, and I have a testifier in the event you have questions.
Thank you, Representative Hillstrom. Is there anyone here? Let's ask if there's questions, and then we'll take testimony if need be. Representative Hoppe?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And Representative Hillstrom, I'm just wondering, is this necessary? I mean, are there people that are violating this?
Representative Hillstrom?
Mr. Chair, I'd like to defer to my testimony.
State your name and proceed with the testimony.
Mr. Chairman, my name is Carl Crimmins. I'm the president of the Minnesota Pipe Trades Association. And to the question, Representative, no. At this point, there's five state plumbing inspectors. They're all licensed, but it's not in statute where the electrical inspectors in statute are required to be licensed. High-pressure piping inspectors in statute are required to be licensed. But for some reason, this is only in the job description. It's not in statute.
Thank you, Mr. Crimmins. Representative Hoppe, anything further?
Representative David says he thinks we need this, so I'm good.
Thank you, Representative David. Any other testimony, anyone else with questions or concerns with respect to House File 1419? Seeing none, the chair will lay over House File 1419. Thank you, Representative Hillstrom. I see Representative Lesh is in the room. He's got House File 854. The Representative Johnson will move the committee report with respect to House File 854. All in favor say aye.
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 Any opposed, seeing none. That motion prevails. Representative Lesh. Representative Johnson will move House File 854 be recommended passed and referred to the... Where's it going, guys? To the Civil Justice Committee. Representative Lesh,
thank
welcome.
You, Chair. There is an A2 amendment, if the Chair has that.
And that's an author's amendment, Representative Lesh?
Yes, it is.
Representative Johnson will move the A2 amendment. All in favor say aye.
Aye.
Any opposed? Seeing none, that motion prevails. Representative Lesh, your bill.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Mr. Chair, I have been working with the cell phone companies on this, and let me say I've never worked with a nicer group of people than those cell phone companies. It makes me so happy. And that said, I have worked out some compromise, or they've worked out some compromise language along with what went in the Senate, and that was the substitution of the Subdivision 1 language, that if a person calls in and says their phone's lost, there's a rebuttable presumption that the phone is lost or stolen, the customer has suspended service, and they are not liable for usage charges thereafter.
Thank you, Representative Lesh. Is there, well, first, is there anyone that desires to testify with respect to House File 854? There are questions or concerns. I see Representative Hoppe and Representative Davids. Representative Hoppe.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And Representative Lesh, I asked similar questions in the division, but I just am hard-pressed to think that this is something that really needs to be changed in statute. Are you aware of a lot of problems with this?
Representative Lesh?
Mr. Chair, Representative Hoppe. Yes, a constituent brought this up, and it just seems to make sense to me. You know, the carriers are going to say, well, we provide something like this in our contract, but Representative Hoppe, we're here to make laws for our constituents, and in a case where constituents have fallen through the cracks, I think it's an appropriate measure to just enshrine what may be current practices for the cell phone companies, but may not be in the future. I think it makes sense, and it's compromised language, Representative Hoppe.
Representative Hoppe.
Well, thank you, Mr. Chair, and Representative Lesh. I understand that we're here to make laws for our constituents. Do you have more than one constituent or anybody's constituents that's had a problem with this?
Representative Lesh.
Chair, Representative Hoppe. You know, I have heard of similar problems. I can tell you about issues I've had with my bills in the past and attempting to make connections. This is just one facet of one problem, but I think it makes sense.
Representative Hoppe, anything further at this point?
One quick further thing, Mr. Chair. I disagree with my esteemed colleague. I don't think this makes sense. I don't think we need to do it. And I think that this is just kind of silly legislation that we're letting people off the hook if they do something silly with their own cell phone.
Okay. Representative Lesh, anything further to the bill?
Nothing on silliness, Mr. Chair.
Thank you, Representative Lesh. Anyone else with questions or concerns? Otherwise, Representative Johnson renews his motion. That House File 854 is amended to be recommended passed and referred to the Committee on Civil Justice. All in favor say aye.
Aye.
Any opposed?
No.
Motion prevails. Thank you, Representative Lesh. Representative Gunther, is House File 1364?
Mr. Chairman, I move the committee report.
We'd love it if you would move the committee report. Representative David moves the committee report on House File 1364, if there is one. And there is. All in favor say aye.
Aye.
Any opposed? Seeing none, that motion prevails. The Representative Davids will also move House File 1364. Put it before us. Representative Gunther, do you real?
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Members, this is a school boiler bill. And the school engineer requires districts to provide at least 8 hours of training for each year the boiler operator to school personnel licensed to operate the boiler. Boilers, even if they're low-pressure school boilers, are very dangerous, and they can kill someone. They can certainly have go wrong and not be maintained properly, causing the school district very big expenses. And what this will do is this will train the school boiler operator to anticipate problems with the boiler and get them fixed in a timely way. And I think the school board people think that this is a good bill or are at least not objecting to it, and I think it will save them money and their insurance as well as other things. So that's basically the bill. We have Josh here from the SEIU union to answer any questions you have.
Thank you, Representative Gunther. Let's find out. Representative Hoppe.
Thank you, Mr. Chair.
You're not going to tell us this is a silly bill, are you?
Well, I'm going to ask if it's a silly
bill. All right.
Mr. Chair, I'm just kind of wondering, along the lines that I've had about the first couple of bills, do we need it?
Representative Gunther?
Mr. Chair, absolutely we need it. All boilers, whether they're low pressure or high pressure, can explode and cause dangerous injury to people. They're in the school building, and I think this is something to protect them, and it's just as dangerous as a high-pressure boiler. And I've seen a high-pressure boiler shred its broom handle in a minute.
Representative Hoppe?
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and to the author, to the testifier, is this happening? I mean, are we having boilers explode?
Mr. Chair, Joshua Neewise with SEIU. Representative Hoppe, what happened was, this is a compromise between us and the Department of Labor. What was happening is 99% of the people who were taking the boiler engineer's test were passing without ever having seen a boiler. The classes you can take at community college, the books, they'll prepare you to pass the test, but they won't train you to the boiler you're operating. So the Department of Labor made the test harder. Our folks started failing. So this actually gets them training, gets them in the room, gets them operating the boiler safe. You know, a big high school can spend $1 million a year on heating, and fixing one leak saves $10,000. If we have boiler operators who are trained to do this, we're going to see a lot of savings in school district heating budgets.
Thank you. Representative Hoppe, anything further? Any other questions from members of the committee? Chair, layover, House File 1364. Thank you, Representative Gunther. The next bill, I believe that Representative Clark is with us. Representative Clark, you have House File 286. The chair will move that House File 286 be recommended pass and refer to the General Register. Representative Clark, to your bill.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman, committee members. Well, I'm really pleased to bring this bill before you. It's Equal Access to Acupuncture Act, and I wanted to just ask the committee to take just a moment with me to recognize and listen to the witness I brought before you. In addition to the details we're going to give you about what the bill does, one of the things you'll notice in the bill is that it is a memorial to a woman named Edith Davis, who was a leader and founder of acupuncture movement in Minnesota. And her daughter Barbara is here, and I wanted her to spend a moment to say why we have dedicated this bill to her mother.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and committee. My mother, Edith Davis, passed away last spring at the age of 87. She was working up to the end as an acupuncturist and had been on the committee working on this very bill. In the 1970s, when my mother's chronic back pain from polio flared up, she received an acupuncture treatment that took her pain away. She became fascinated with Chinese medicine and took up its study. She was at the time on the board of Group Health, which is now Health Partners, and saw how Chinese medicine could complement existing Western medical techniques. She became one of Minnesota's earliest acupuncturists. She helped start one of the first clinics, establish the professional association, and lead the fight for licensure. She served on national committees for creating professional educational standards, and if that weren't enough, she started the first successful professional school of Chinese medicine in Minnesota, finally retiring from the presidency at the age of 78. As Minnesota's healthcare system became dominated by third-party coverage, my mother led the fight for patients to have acupuncture covered by their healthcare plans and for acupuncturists to be reimbursed. My mother would have been honored to have this bill named for her. This bill is one more step in the great quest of improving Minnesota's healthcare system. Thank you.
Thank you, Representative Clark.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I'd like to remind people that what we're doing with this bill is providing that if health insurance already covers acupuncture performed by a physician, it must cover acupuncture in the same way as performed by a licensed acupuncture practitioner. And just to give a little more background on that, I'd like to ask Kimberly.
Representative Clark, if I might, just so we're clear, this is not a new mandate.
Right, it's not.
And I'm not aware of any opposition.
Okay.
Let me, if I might, is there anybody here? And we've got lots of letters in support.
Okay.
I'm aware of some folks that have some concerns, not necessarily opposition per se, okay. But anybody that has sent us a email or letter, that will more than suffice for, that will be made part of the record. We will
okay.
accept that as part of the record.
Okay.
And I'm saying this not to be rude, but because we've got 18 more bills.
Right, I know where you're going.
so if we can get through a couple of comments relative to it, see what the concerns are, and then we'll see what sort of questions or concerns members of the committee have, and we'll go from there. So,
thank you. We'll be very brief.
Okay, thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman, members of the committee. My name is Kimberly Fritz. I'm a licensed acupuncturist and president of the Acupuncture and Oriental Medicine Association of Minnesota. To be brief, just to reiterate, this is not a mandate. All we are asking is that the current health plans that are covering acupuncture include that reimbursement to the licensed acupuncturist. There are many health plans now that will reimburse a medical doctor or a doctor of chiropractic and yet exclude the expert, the licensed acupuncturist, who has much greater education in this therapy. We understand there are concerns about increasing coverage. Again, that is not our goal at this point in time.
Yeah.
All we're saying is if a health plan chooses to say that they cover acupuncture, that they will also reimburse the licensed acupuncturist.
Thank you.
Thank you. Can I have one more witness who will also be very brief? Dr. Charles Sawyer.
Dr. Sawyer, welcome to the committee.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Members of the committee, my name is Charles Sawyer, and I'm the Senior Vice President at Northwestern Health Sciences University in Bloomington, and I'm also a chiropractic doctor. We also support House File 286 since it will eliminate the discriminatory inequity that currently inhibits licensed acupuncturists from receiving insurance reimbursement otherwise available to medical physicians and other healthcare professionals who also use acupuncture. Now, the current situation is not in the best interest of the patient who may have an acupuncture service provision in his or her insurance plan, but then must pay out of pocket when deciding to consult the most qualified provider in the event that they feel acupuncture might be of help to them for their health problems. You may hear objections that this legislation would require health plans to provide reimbursement for acupuncture services for all patients and under all clinical circumstances. As you know, insurance companies currently reject many medical procedures and treatments they consider to be without merit, and this legislation would not change that practice. The intent of the bill, however, is to simply require that they reimburse acupuncturists if the insured has an acupuncture benefit in their plan, and yet would otherwise have to seek that service from a medical physician or someone else who's licensed but not as equally qualified. Please don't also be persuaded with assertions that there is no evidence of acupuncture efficacy or effectiveness. This is an equally specious argument, since most plans here in Minnesota and throughout the country, as a matter of fact, already provide an acupuncture benefit and do so because they have established that there is value. Representative Atkins and members, thank you for the opportunity to speak on behalf of this bill.
Thank you, Dr. Sawyer. And it is my understanding Ms. Coleman has some testimony. There may well be others. Well, welcome back.
Thank you. Mr. Chair and members of the committee, I apologize. We had some confusion on testifying, but for the record, my name is Jeanette Coleman, and I'm the Vice President of Public Policy and Government Affairs for Medica, and today I'm here before you representing the 8 nonprofit health plans from the Minnesota Council of Health Plans. And I do want to set some concerns that we have with this. First, I just want to clarify a couple things quickly. It is true that most health plans reimburse MDs and chiropractors for a narrow scope of acupuncture services where there's adequate scientific evidence documented to show its efficacy. I want to clarify that in many instances, the services being provided that are reimbursed are in fact being provided by a licensed acupuncturist with the training reflected by the previous testimony. So while it is accurate to say that these are then billed through a physician or chiropractor who's overseeing the treatment plan. So while it is accurate to say that all health plans do not reimburse acupuncturists directly, it is not accurate to say that we do not reimburse services provided by a licensed acupuncturist for some treatments. We do believe that this legislation will add cost in two different ways. Currently, it is true that this does not create a mandate for acupuncture for these services. If we don't already provide them, we don't have to. But what it will do by opening up access to acupuncturists, it will expand the number of people receiving these services being covered under their insurance company. So, for example, many people pay for these alternative therapies out of their own pocket. This is true for many alternative therapies. In addition to acupuncture, it includes massage therapy, healing touch, herbal medicine, to name a couple. And by mandating direct access to acupuncture, these costs will be shifted to individuals who are paying this out of the pocket to the insurance pool. So it will impact costs there. Secondly, this will add administrative costs to the health plans, because the health plans will be required to credential these providers and to implement management structures and techniques that ensure services are not overutilized and that services to treat diagnoses that are not supported by the science, such as digestive disorders and addiction disorders, are not being provided for or paid for under insurance. And I'd also just like to point out there are other options for individuals who want to receive some sort of reimbursement for these services. Many health plans do have discount programs in place for these services where people can go and get a discount if they receive these services. In addition, you can pay for acupuncture services with pre-tax dollars through flexible spending accounts and or the health savings account. And I would just finally point out that there are other licensed healthcare professionals that are not reimbursed directly. This is not limited to acupuncture. So we don't reimburse registered nurses directly. We don't reimburse massage therapists directly. But these are some services that are eligible and that we do provide coverage for. So with that, I would take any questions.
Okay. Thank you, Ms. Coleman. I just want to make sure that if there's I saw Mr. Griffin, maybe he was deferring to you, but I... Is there anybody else that desires to testify in opposition to the bill? Okay. All right, then we'll look for members' questions or concerns. Representative Anderson?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Ms. Coleman, if this was put in place, would you guys just not offer that coverage since it would just be a mandate on those that provide that coverage?
Ms. Coleman?
Mr. Chair and Representative Anderson, the legislation as it's written does say that if you provide these services, so there is certainly an argument to make that a health plan may make the decision to just not cover these services under any circumstance through any provider. That being said, we do think that in limited circumstances for some individuals, this is a viable option, and depending on what the cost would be, that is a possibility that would just be taken off the table. I assure you, if that would happen, I believe the same advocates would be back next year with the actual mandate, though.
Is there any other questions for Ms. Coleman or for Representative Clark? If not, the chair will renew his motion that House File 286 be recommended pass and refer to the General Register. All in favor say aye.
Aye.
Any opposed? Motion prevails. Thank you, Representative Clark.
You,
stick around there because I see we've got one more bill from you the folks up there probably wish was Sunday sales, but it's not. House File 2114 allows a special liquor license for the City of Minneapolis. The chair will move House File 2114. Representative Clark, there's my understanding that there's an A2 amendment, an author's amendment.
I believe there is, Mr. Chairman.
And the chair will move the A2 amendment to put it in the shape that the...
I can invite Mr. Redmond to join.
We just want to make sure we've got the number right. That it may well be an A1 rather than an A2 amendment, but we want to...
Mr.
McCormick, it's the A1 amendment, correct? So the chair will move the A1 amendment to put it into the shape that the author desires to proceed. All in favor say aye.
Aye.
Any opposed? Seeing none, Representative Clark, to your bill as amended, For folks that aren't familiar with proposed bills relative to alcohol, this bill will be laid over for potential inclusion in the omnibus liquor bill on Thursday. Representative Clark, to your bill.
Okay, thank you, Mr. Chairman. And I do have with me Mark here. I didn't want to say that right. He was going to talk a little bit about this, but basically what this is...
Representative Clark, can you speak into the... pull the microphone down?
Okay, there we go.
Thank you.
This would basically allow for an establishment located at now the corrected amendment for 2309 Window Avenue South to be able to do off-sale liquor, have an off-sale liquor license for sale only of wine and malt liquor. Basically, we're talking about a Trader Joe's establishment that will be added to an existing housing and grocery development. So I'd like to ask Mr. Duke to talk a little bit about that.
Okay. Welcome to the committee. If you can just identify yourself and proceed with your testimony.
My name is Mark Vincent Duke. Last name is spelled D-Z-I-U-K. I reside at 2209 Lindale Avenue South, the actual neighborhood where I'm proposing this project. Mr. Chair Atkinson, we have some handouts I'd like all the members of the committee to have. It would be easy for everybody to follow along with what I'm proposing.
If you just give them to one of the special assistants to the committee, they'll distribute it.
It's going around, Mr. Chair.
But you can feel free to proceed with your testimony as they're being distributed.
Okay. First and foremost, this is a phase two, an extension of a project that I began developing and building in the Whittier neighborhood off of 2209 Lindale in January 2006. That building is complete. It's a mixed-use project. It's known as Le Parisien. I myself am a small entrepreneurial businessman. I have lived or worked in this neighborhood for the last 18 years. I come from the computer industry. I had an assistive computer technology company that accommodated people with disabilities for approximately 10 years here in the state of Minnesota. Sold that company about 6 years ago and then started a development firm that simply really tries to bring innovation to situations like the mixed-use environment, which I'm proposing here today. When we get the handouts, does everybody have one of these? Okay, this would be easiest for us to follow.
I think so.
On the front of this postcard is a picture of the project Le Parisien, which again I started in 2006. It is complete, although we have a vacancy with our commercial. There's an orange dot, and just below the orange dot is the suggestion of phase two. This picture was painted here about 4 years ago. So what I'm talking about here is a plan, an urban renewal plan for this block that I began working on 4+ years ago. And just below the orange dot is the peak of what we're going to be talking about today. That's to the north of Le Parisien. I might add that Le Parisien has won several awards as far as condo of the year, primarily for its building biology that I've introduced into it and its innovation as far as the hallway-less design. On the bottom of the postcard are several different focal points to consider. If you flip the postcard to the next page, you'll see an orange dot again. And below that orange dot is this next project called Le Parisien 2. It's primarily a housing project, but it also has a commercial component. And that commercial component is a Trader Joe's. I have a signed contract with them. Behind this white document is a letter it's a pink letter. Everybody can see that. It's from the neighborhood. And the director, Marion Dean, from the neighborhood, is here. She's just stepped out for a second. She went to go get our... here. Okay. So we'll bring her up. Okay. You fine, Larry? Okay. So here's a letter of support that Marion Dean will address in a minute. The purple documents are actual lists of specialty boutique bottles of wine that Trader Joe's offers, typically not found in the average store. They do a lot of private labeling. And the yellow attachment is the beer that they offer. Again, it's very boutique. They don't carry Budweiser, Grain Belt. You don't find a lot of direct competition. with what they offer. We're not talking spirits. It's strictly wine and beer. And it's a critical part of this phase two. Without it, this project doesn't occur. With it, we create about 130 jobs, 85 of those coming from Trader Joe's, and the remaining coming from a mixture of a bank here that we're talking with to bring in next to Trader Joe's, and then the completion of the commercial project, a component of the Perugian 1. I'll conclude there and open to discussion.
Okay. Thank you for your comments. You have a question to kind of wait till we get through the testimony, Representative
Hoppe? Sure.
All right. Thank you. Is there anyone else that desires to, and we'll come back for questions, Mr. Chuck. Are there others that wish to testify with respect to it?
Just one very brief testimony from the neighborhood, Mr.
Yep, we saw there's a letter in support of it. Welcome to the committee.
Good evening. I'm sorry, I'm not
all you need
very
to do is
comfortable.
Just, all you got to do is just say who you are and how you feel about it.
My name is Marion Dean. I'm executive director for the Whittier Alliance neighborhood that the McCreehan, who is recommending this proposal. The neighborhood, if you know, is a very large neighborhood in South Minneapolis. It is a very active and engaged neighborhood. The Parisian one came through, and we had a lot of neighborhood discussion about it. It has been a successful investment in the neighborhood. This proposal is at the point where it needs to be brought forward to the neighborhood for full disclosure and presentation so the neighborhood can have an opportunity to decide on the merits of its full potential. Not having been through the full neighborhood process, what I am here to recommend is that it be granted the opportunity to at least come forward, and whatever action that is that is required by you, so that we can have a full discussion on having this investment in our neighborhood.
Great. Thank you very much. We appreciate your comments. Is there anyone else that desires to testify? Yes, sir. Welcome back.
Thank you, sir. Mr. Chair, my name is Frank Ball. I'm the executive director of the Minnesota License and Beverage Association. We would oppose this bill for a couple of reasons. We just found out about it today. There is a process for these type of liquor variances to go through. And we feel as though it's missed some of the very important agencies and government agencies to go forward, such as the Minneapolis City Council, Minneapolis Licensing, the Minneapolis Police Department, and we've been contacted by two city council members that said they have not had a chance to review this bill. Our members are concerned about the concentration of alcohol in this particular area. There is a variance to the set procedures that are taking place in Minneapolis, and with many of these unanswered questions, we would hope that you would not support this particular legislation. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Ball. Is there anyone else who desires to testify with respect to this?
Mr. Chairman, I can respond to one of the concerns. If you want me to wait, I can do that.
Well, why don't we get Mr. Rossler, who's darn near there, moving pretty good.
There you go.
And we'll hear from him, and then we'll see if there's questions or comments.
Okay.
Chairman, applicants, members of the committee, my name is Ken Rockler. I'm the executive director of the Tavern League, and I would echo what Frank Ball just said on that, and then just add one more point, and that's that I believe that it goes contrary to a specific ordinance that Minneapolis passed in addition to the state laws there regarding the proximity to a school. So I also would ask that it go through the normal processes at this point. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Rockler. Are there questions or comments from members of the committee? And Representative Clark?
Yes, could I just say one thing and to clarify that a couple of the last comments, Mr. Chair?
Certainly.
This is just the beginning of the process here. The point about the city being able to discuss this, and the city council members have not discussed it yet, it will enable it to go to the city council members for that kind of review and discussion, and that's where that decision will be made. We're not making it here to decide it. And there is a letter on your desk from the city council member in the area who happens to be also the vice president of the city council, and he's interested in seeing the legislation passed, so they can discuss it there and see if it's appropriate.
Thank you, Representative Clark. Representative Antelope, you had a question?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. To the MLBA testifier, the question is there a liquor outlet nearby, near the proposed development? And if so, wouldn't the city of Minneapolis ultimately be the decision maker as to whether or not to allow the variance in the first place? And what do you have against a little competition?
Mr. Ball?
Mr. Chair, Representative, there's a process to go through on this, in this regulated industry. There are approximately, I would say, we're just in the process of contacting them because we just found out about this bill. We have about 7 members that are within that probably, fine, 7 members that are within that probably a 10-block area, and there's approximately 7 more that are non-members, and these are off-sale liquor establishments that affect that area. I don't know the exact geographic location of this development. I haven't been over there. We just found out about this. But yes, there's a process to go through, and the ultimate authority, well, the ultimate authority is yours, certainly, but the process has to start at the licensing center, which is the city of Minneapolis that has that particular jurisdiction.
Thank you, Mr. Ball. And that is actually the way we prefer our testifiers, is on bent knee. Wow. You didn't know you had that kind of power, huh, Representative Antelope? Are there other questions or concerns that members have? And seeing no further... Mr. Rockler, did you come back to provide further testimony, or just if we had questions?
Sure, that's why.
All right, good enough.
Thank you.
Well, thank you all very much. This bill is, with all of the alcohol-related bills, be laid over potential inclusion. House Chair lays over House File 2114. Thank you very much, and thank you to the folks that came and testified. Representative Mullery, we've got a couple of bills that House File 19... the chair will move that that House File 19's committee report be adopted. All in favor say aye.
Aye.
Any opposed? Seeing none, that motion prevails. Representative Mullery will then move that House File 19 be recommended pass and referred to the Committee on Civil Justice. Representative Mullery, to your bill.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and members. It's really a simple bill, and as happened in Representative Dabney's committee, several people said, how in the world did you ever get the people to agree to something like this on both the mortgagors and the lenders? And I think the easiest way to explain this bill is, pardon me, members, but I've got a cough lozenge in because about a half hour ago I couldn't stop coughing. The easiest way to explain this bill is when you, is just maybe with pins indicating, when you start a foreclosure, you send out the original notices for a sheriff's sale, and then later you have the sheriff's sale, usually about 4 months later. Then by law, you have the end of the redemption period, which is 6 months later. And during this period, before the sheriff's sale, you can reinstate. You only have to pay the back payments on the mortgage. After the sheriff's sale, you have to pay off the entire mortgage if you want to redeem within that 6 month period. And so what this bill does is it moves the at the request of the mortgagor, it moves the sheriff's sale 5 months later, and then shortens the redemption period to 5 weeks, which is the same redemption period we use for abandoned property. And this bill was drafted by the Bar Association, their lobbyists on the real property section. And what it does, therefore, is it gives somebody who's out of work, or maybe they lost and got laid off, they may have had health problems, it gives them time to get back and earn enough to make the arrearages up to 5 months longer. So there's no downside for anybody, and the bankers and lenders, they have no problem with it because they still are getting the property just as fast. So they have no problem with it.
So basically, we found something that is truly what Representative Davis likes to call peace in the valley. It's a true win-win situation because the bankers, it's kind of funny when I remember one of the governor's staff, when I brought it up last year, it was too late to get it all put together, but they called certain leading Republican attorneys who work in the field of foreclosure and represent banks, and they said, no, it's a fantastic bill. Everybody wins because the banks this way get a lot more people to reinstate in that period, and because they have a longer period to make up arrearages, and almost any type of decent lender wants a reinstatement. They don't want, they got enough properties out there right now. They don't want more properties. So basically that's it, and we have not had a single person that's not in agreement on it. So,
no kidding. On a Mullery bill? Is there anybody that just wants to come up with some opposition to this? I mean, even if you're not here to testify again, just come on down.
Just on principle.
Mr. Chairman, I missed the bill. I could pretty much come in blind and just start complaining if you'd like.
Nah. Thank you, Representative Mullery. Is there anyone that desires to be heard with respect to House File 19? Any other questions or concerns with regard to it? I am kind of interested if the tape ever gets transcribed to see how they determine if we went here with the pen description. I don't think that'll quite come through, but it made a lot of sense. That was good. We're running out of table there for a while. But with that, Representative Mullery will renew his motion that House File 19 be recommended passed and re-referred to the Committee on Civil Justice. All in favor say aye.
Aye.
Any opposed? Seeing none, that motion prevails. Thank you, Representative Mullery. And you're up with House File 903. Representative Dabney will move the committee report with respect to House File 903. All in favor say aye.
Aye.
Motion prevails. Representative Mullery will then move that House File 903 be recommended to pass and referred to the Committee on Civil Justice. There is an amendment being passed out. It's my understanding, Representative Mullery, this is an author's amendment that
yes.
Representative Mullery will author will move the A903-101 amendment to put it in the shape that the author desires to proceed with it. All in favor say aye.
Aye.
Any opposed? Seeing none, that motion prevails. Representative Mullery, two-year bill is amended.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And this also had no opposition in the last committee. Basically, what this does for those of you that were here in 2004, we went after we won't call them sleazy, but they're not quite the most up and up people that were getting into the foreclosure consultant business. And so we had bills, and we had a good new law, 325N.01. That closed most of the loopholes we were aware of. But these people, unfortunately, aren't dumb, and they figure out ways around it. So while we had obtained a forbearance in there, they would say, well, we're negotiating or modifying the terms of an existing residential mortgage loan. And so we have to close that loophole. And then there's a couple of other loopholes where under the original law, they were not supposed to get paid until they'd completed the work. And so we're just providing also in two places for that. And basically that's the bill. And Ms. Heil from the Attorney General's office is here to explain the problem more in detail.
Thank you, Representative Mullery. Let's find out, no offense to Ms. Heil, but let's see if there's concerns or questions from, and I'll also ask, is there any opposition to the bill? Any questions, concerns from members? That was a pretty good explanation, Representative Mullery, and we appreciate that. And we'd love to hear from Ms. Heil, but I think
you also want to go home tonight.
Perhaps if we had a visual aid, we could...
Do you have your pens available, Representative Mullery? All right, Representative Mullery will renew his motion that House File 903, as amended, be recommended, passed, and referred to the Committee on Civil Justice. All in favor say aye.
Aye.
Is there any opposition? Seeing none, motion prevails. Thank you both very much. Next up is Representative Mason, I believe, joined us. And for anybody that's kind of new to how we do business. When we have, we tend to do member bills later, and non-members that show up, we take them as they come to try to be as respectful of their time as we can. So House File 1202 is Representative Mason's bill. The chair will move that House File 1202 be recommended pass and refer to the General Register. Representative Mason, it's my understanding that you have, that this is an author's amendment, the A09?
Exactly.
All right. The chair will move the A09-0245 amendment to put the bill in the shape that the author desires to proceed. All in favor say aye.
Aye.
Any opposed? Seeing none, Representative Mason, to your bill.
Okay. Mr. Chair, members, can I make two oral amendments as well on this? In line 110, can you delete death benefits and put in cash value? And then in line 111, change with to within.
Okay, and the chair will then move that oral amendment, just to repeat it so everybody's clear. It'll be on line 1, or I'm sorry, on page 1, line 10, delete the words death benefit and insert cash value. On page 1, line 11, delete the word with and insert the word within. That's an author's amendment. All in favor say aye.
Aye.
Any opposition? Seeing none, that motion prevails. Representative Mason, to the bill.
Thank you for your patience. Essentially, what we're trying to do is just update this a little bit, and what I will do, if you'd like testimony, to ask Mr. Plank to give the details.
Mr. Plank, welcome to the committee.
Thank you. My name is Doug Plank. I'm a volunteer board member for the National Association of Insurance and Financial Advisors in Minnesota. We seek in this HF number 1202 to put into subdivision 10 the insurance proceeds to actually spell out the $43,000 excluded subject to that subdivision in the bankruptcy laws. The second thing we're looking for is on life insurance cash values, to allow those cash values to have to grow inside a policy at a rate that is enough to support the policy to the ultimate death of the insured in the policy, so that they're not forced to withdraw cash values from a policy that are there to support the long-term death benefit, which is the ultimate goal when people buy life insurance, is to have a death benefit for their family.
Thank you, Mr. Plank. Is there anyone else here that desires to testify with respect to this bill? Seeing none, Representative, we'll take questions. Representative David?
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. You say sufficient cash value to, are we talking each 121? Are we talking about the most recent table?
Mr. Plank?
Actually, the code that we're looking to establish what is sufficient is the IRC, the Internal Revenue Code, Section 7702, which defines life insurance. That code is not necessarily up to an age 121, which is a modern. I'm not sure that it will be adjusted for 121.
Mr. Chairman,
Representative David,
and to the testifier, does this include MEC and non-MEC contracts?
The Section 7702 specifically defines what a MEC is and what a non-MEC is, and this would only be non-MEC contracts. So not those abusive investment contracts as MEC is defined.
Representative Davis?
Mr. Chairman, to the gentleman, since when is a non-MEC an abusive, whatever you said?
No, the MEC contracts are generally thought of as abusive contracts. That's why 7702 was amended in 1988. To put a MEC rule in so that people couldn't put too much money into their life insurance contract.
Well, Mr. Chairman, to the testifier, if somebody has a MEC today, that doesn't necessarily mean they're being abusive because it doesn't work for them anyway.
Mr. Plank.
Pardon my use of that word. I
was
that's a yeah, that was a good word to pull back. You didn't. We'll strike that one. We'll have that one erased with some white out when the...
Thank you.
But, Mr. Plank, try that one again.
Okay. Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
Thank you, Representative David. Are there other questions or concerns with respect to the bill? Otherwise, the chair will renew his motion that House File 1202 be recommended pass and referred to the General Register. As amended, be referred to the General Register. All in favor say aye.
Aye.
Any opposed? Seeing none, that motion prevails. Thank you, Representative Mason. Thank you, Mr. Plank.
Thank you very much.
Representative Zellers, you ready for 1807 and 1510?
Zellers.
the end of the amendment.
Good luck. Yeah. This is what we all wait for each year. Is Representative Zellers will move House File 1807. This is an alcohol-related bill, so it'll be laid over at the end of the testimony for potential inclusion in the liquor omnibus bill. Representative Zellers, your bill.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and find the right version here. The 1807, and for the members of the committee, we all work on constituent service, as I'll tell you that this is one of the most detailed and constituent service-oriented bills that I have carried at the legislature. There's a number of folks that travel quite a bit of time at the airport. My mother-in-law happens to be one of those folks who spends quite a bit of time at the airport. In the months of January, February, March, she will be in the state of Minnesota 9 days this year. So on behalf of her and many other folks who spend very long hours and layovers waiting for flights, waiting for a delayed flight, this bill is quite simply, I have a phone a friend as well, this bill quite simply extends those hours for folks who are going to be stuck at the airport. I can go into some of the economic and jobs benefits of some of the local restaurants at the airport, but I think for most members, it's a pretty easy bill to say if you're stuck at the airport, you can have maybe an adult beverage as you wait for your layover.
And just so we're clear, Representative Zellers, it's only for folks that are past the security checkpoints and are so they're either getting on a flight or they're changing flights or something like that. Is that right?
Out of deference to our airline providers in the state, I won't say being held hostage, but I will say that you do have to be in the airport and pass the security gate, so you do have to have a boarding pass to get into the area.
I think as long as you don't say abusive, we're all okay. But are there questions for Representative Zellers at this point, or anyone that desires to be heard with respect to the bill? And I see we've got I don't know if you've been before, so I was going to say welcome back, but I don't know if you've been here yet this committee, this session. But what's your perspective with respect to it?
Mitch Killian, Metropolitan Airport Commission. Thank you, Mr. Chairman. And the MAC has been before you, but I guess I haven't been yet this session. It continues to be a customer service issue for us at the airport. As you know, we have about 50% of our passengers are just connecting and coming through Minneapolis and connecting and moving on to another location. So our competition, of course, for that is places like Cincinnati, Detroit. And so as a customer service issue for us, we'd like to make the stay at MSP as convenient as possible and as good as possible. And it just answers a lot of complaints that we're getting that as people are coming through different time zones, that they're able to have an adult beverage, as it's put, as they're passing through MSP.
Thank you, Mr. Killian. This is along the lines of it's 5 o'clock somewhere, wherever they may have been coming from. Representative Hoppe.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I have a question about employees at the airport, about like the bartenders and service staff. Do they support this? Is this a good thing for them, the workers there?
Mr. Chairman, Representative, we haven't polled them, but I know that the operators of the businesses, with our passenger numbers down, are continue to look for new revenue streams, so they're supportive. And I would just think that it's probably a natural outfall for the bartenders and things that are working any holiday shift, not able to get the tips during that time that the drinks might produce. I would imagine that most would be supportive.
Thank you, Mr. Killian. Representative Hoppe. Any others with questions or concerns? Anyone else who desires to testify? Otherwise, Chair will lay over House File 1807 for potential inclusion in the liquor omnibus bill. Thank you, Representative Zellers. You also have House File 1510, and Representative Zellers will move House File 1510. Your
Thank
bill.
You, Mr. Chair. And rather than get in the way of a real person from the real world who's going to have to leave here in about 50 minutes, I will defer to the testifier, Mr. Chairman.
Okay. Welcome to the committee.
Mr. Chair, members, this is just a clarification of a practice that's long been taking place.
And if you can clarify for us your name.
Absolutely. I'm sorry. My name is Edward Cadman. I'm a staff attorney with the League of Minnesota Cities. And this simply clarifies that public facilities such as a park, shelter, or community center can allow non-commercial alcohol use without a license. If you have any questions about it, we know of no opposition to this bill.
Thank you, Mr. Gavin. Is there anyone else who desires to testify with respect to the bill? Any questions or comments from members of the committee? then the chair will lay over House File 1510 for potential inclusion in the liquor omnibus bill. Thank you, Representative Zellers. Thank you, Mr. Cabin. Representative Fritz, are you all set? All right. And just as a heads up, we'll do Representative Fritz's bill, and then we'll go to Representative Kahn's Sunday sales bill after that. Representative Fritz will move, and it'll pop into me. House File 1789, be recommended to pass, and we refer to the General Register. Representative Fritz, your bill.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman and members. This is a bill that was brought to me, and I do have my testifier with me. This is a bill relating to insurance for nonprofit agency, insurance companies, and I would like to turn it over to my testifier.
Thank you, Representative Chair.
Thank you. The reason I'm here is, my name is Mike Frenchu. I'm the fund administrator of the Minnesota Nonprofit Employers Workers' Compensation Fund. The fund has been in existence since 1995, and we're kind of in a weird situation because we're all insuring nonprofit organizations, but subsequently we end up having to pay federal income tax because the way the self-insured group program is set up, there is no such entity that exists, and what we're trying to do is incorporate, but the self-insurance law specifically bars us from doing it. What we're attempting to do, since already under the political subdivision section of the 47198, certain nonprofit organizations are allowed to form a group, what we're asking is that it just be all 317A corporations that would be added to that definition so we could go ahead and form our own trust.
Thank you, Mr. Frenchel. And is it specifically what you only do workers' compensation insurance?
Right now we only do workers' compensation. In the future we could branch into other types of coverage.
Okay. Is there anyone else that desires to testify with respect to the bill? Any questions or concerns from members of the committee? All right, with that, Representative Fritz will renew her motion that House File 1789 be recommended to pass and referred to the... Actually, I wanted to make sure I believe there may have been an amendment. Is that right?
I do not have an amendment.
Okay, then we're clear. Well, Representative Fritz renews her motion that House File 1789 be recommended to pass and referred to the General Register. All in favor say aye.
Aye.
Any of Representative Johnson's in favor anyway. Any opposition? None. That passes 1-0. Thank you very much.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Thank you, members.
Thank you,
Mr. Chairman. Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Representative Kahn, I'm told, is in the chair will move that House File 1294, and this is an alcohol-related bill, so it'll be laid over for potential inclusion, but it's my understanding, Representative Kahn, there is an A1 amendment, and it's an author's amendment?
Yes.
Okay, the chair will move the A1 amendment. All in favor say aye.
Aye.
Any opposed? Seeing none, that motion prevails. Representative Condi, your bill is amended.
Okay. Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I feel much more comfortable just dealing with alcohol sales than the car sales portion of the bill.
We all thought you might.
Thank you for taking that off. Mr. Chairman, Minnesota is one of the few states remaining that still has remnants of the blue laws from the times of the Puritans. And this was, and the one that we're trying to deal with now is the sale of alcohol, the off sale of alcohol on Sunday. This is certainly, at this time, an important revenue addition to the state. The estimates have ranged from $4 million up to $10 million in terms of increased revenue to the state. The best statement I've actually heard in opposition to the bill came from the owner of a liquor store in Hudson, Wisconsin, who said that 75% of his Sunday business comes from Minnesota. Mr. Chairman, there are people much more knowledgeable than me to speak about this, so I would actually like to bring up the people to address the bill at this time. I'd like to...
Just have them come on down.
Okay.
It's like the price
John
is right.
Wolf of Chicago, right?
Mr. Wolf, welcome to the committee. Please identify yourself for the record and proceed with your testimony.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman, members of the committee. My name is John Wolf. I am the owner of Chicago Lake Liquors in South Minneapolis. I am testifying in favor of Sunday sales, and I'll give you a little background. Minnesota's ban is often referred to as one of the few remaining blue laws, believed so named because they were written on blue paper and date to the 1600s, when things like shaving, traveling, commerce, dancing, cooking, and kissing were outlawed on Sunday, in keeping with the morality of the era.
Hunting in some places.
Hunting in some places also. The rules are archaic, a remnant of the olden days, which are fun to read about, but not very practical when you want to run out, pick up a bottle of wine, but you know what? It happens to be Sunday. This antiquated ban is out of step with the lives of most Minnesotans. With today's dual-income families, Sunday has become the second busiest shopping day of the week. At its core, this Sunday sales bill is about fairness. And it is only fair for all sides to admit we already have sales on Sunday in Minnesota. Bars, restaurants, the Metrodome, the Guthrie, convenience stores, grocery stores, all can sell alcohol on Sunday. Only liquor stores are forbidden. It is illogical for society bent on reducing drunken driving to tell its citizens that they can have a drink on Sunday, but they have to drive somewhere to buy it and consume it before driving home. The argument that Sunday prohibitionism saves lives could be compelling if it were logical or true. It is illogical because only allowing alcohol sales to those who choose to drive to and from a place where they can drink flies in the face of reason. It is untrue because virtually every study that has tested it has found no increase in alcohol-related accidents or fatalities after allowing Sunday sales. A broader analysis of the 13 states that have repealed Sunday sales bans since 2002 show that it has been a huge success both commercially and socially. It's been a boon for consumers, and there's been no negative social impact in the states that have moved to Sunday sales. It is unfair for the state to create an uneven playing field when some types of businesses are allowed to profit from Sunday sales while others are not. It is also unfair for liquor stores in border cities to lose millions of dollars in business to their competition a few miles away in Wisconsin, Iowa, North Dakota, and South Dakota, all of which allow Sunday sales. People who want to drink on Sundays are going to do so. The only question is whether the state of Minnesota wants to share in the revenue. Believe it or not, and I'm sure you'll hear later, one of the great oppositions to Sunday sales are from my fellow retailers. Their chief concern is they would have to pay to staff stores for an additional day, but overall sales would not increase. They argue the sales they generate in 6 days would just end up being spread over 7. Let's say you follow this logic. Then why shouldn't the government prohibit the sale of, let's say consumer electronics on Tuesdays, so those businesses can save a day's worth of overhead? It's an argument that is at cross purpose with the basic tenets of capitalism. 3 years ago, I led a similar effort on 10 p.m. store closings. Other retailers and the MLBA, Minnesota Licensed Beverage Association, spoke out against such a change. It passed, and to my knowledge, those opposed have not been negatively impacted. In fact, some of those loudest in opposition are now open until 10 p.m. Let me stress that it is a choice to be open on Sunday. This should be a business decision, not decided by public policy. Let's bring Minnesota into the 21st century and join the vast majority of other states in allowing Sunday sales.
Thank you, Mr. Wolf.
Mr. Chairman, the next person I'd like to come is Jay Hibbard, who's from the Distilled Spirits Council of the United States. came here from Washington to meet with us.
That must be why we got this fancy book. Folks in Washington, yeah. They make fancy books.
A lot of paper.
Thank you.
Jeffrey Hibbard, welcome to the committee. My name is Jay Hibbard, and as Representative Khan said, I represent the Distilled Spirits Council of the United States. We're the National Trade Association representing the producers and marketers of distilled spirits sold here in the state of Minnesota. Thanks for the opportunity to be here with you today and to voice our support for House File 1294, which would allow the sale of beer, wine, and distilled spirits on Sunday. As the chairman has said, you have been provided some background information, including a fairly detailed economic analysis, as well as a report entitled Sunday Sales, a Commercial and Social Success. I won't certainly recount all of those. I'll take just a couple minutes to highlight some of the findings. In the last few years, repeal of these Prohibition-era blue laws has been occurring all over the country because the states have realized they really have no place in a modern society. The change here proposed for Minnesota would have benefits for the state of Minnesota, benefits to Minnesota's small businesses, and benefits to customers. As Mr. Wolf stated, Minnesota is surrounded by states that allow the Sunday sales of spirits, beer, and wine, and that resulting tax revenue is crossing your borders every week. Our economic analysis would indicate that the Sunday sale of beer, wine, and distilled spirits would represent a 5-7% increase in the sale of those products in the volume, and that would generate an additional $7.6 to $10.6 million in new tax revenue for the state, as well as $54 to $76 million in new retail sales for small businesses. So those are clear benefits in these difficult economic times. Certainly there'd be additional benefits to consumers as well. As Mr. Wolf indicated, with modern households having two working members, they depend more and more on Sunday shopping hours. Sunday being the second most important shopping day of the week, when the market basket is 21% higher on Sunday than it is on other days of the week. Since 2002, 14 states have repealed outdated blue laws banning Sunday spirit sales, bringing the total now to 36 states that allow off-premise sales. And the states that modernized their laws between 2002 and 2005, which was 12 states at that time, Sunday sales generated $212 million in new sales in 2006, which ranges from a 5-8% increase in new retail sales. Sunday sales has been a commercial success, it has been a social success, it has given modern two-income couples an extra day to shop for their preferred beverages without any of the negative impact on underage drinking or drunk driving. In closing, we certainly urge your favorable report on House File 1294. Thanks for the opportunity to be here today.
Thank you, Mr. Hibbard. Representative Khan?
Yeah, Mr. Chairman, there's one more person who would like to speak. That's one of the places from a border store which are highly affected by our law. This is Mr. Barney Nessus from Wanamingo, south along the border.
Thank you. Please state your name for the record and go ahead when you're ready, sir.
Barney Nessus. I'm the owner of Hometown Wine and Spirits in Wanamingo, Minnesota, which is about 20 minutes to the border. I'm in Draz's district. I just wanted to make it short and quick. The big thing for small stores like me and everybody along the border is everybody's going to Wisconsin. We're losing, lots of revenue, lots of business for me. I mean, that would be almost a gravy day from a business standpoint because your fixed assets, your fixed costs are already there. So, I mean, any extra profit I could make on Sunday could go into new equipment, all kinds of things. And I just, I'm in support of it. I think it's just a good idea, in closing, I just don't want to send our money to the cheapers, let's keep it.
Thank you very much, sir. Representative Khan?
Well, Mr. Chairman, I'd like to answer any questions from members of the committee, or rather have the people who obviously know much more about it than I do answer those questions.
Is there anybody on that'd like to be heard against the bill?
Do we have a whole list?
Okay, go ahead and give me that. Mr. Madigan?
Cliff.
Mr. Gerbsmeyer, do you want to come? Mr. Gerbsmeyer, I think I'd like you first.
You're going to get me and Mr. Madigan together. We're going to speed this up.
Okay.
Mr. Chairman, members, my name is Mike Madigan. I represent the Minnesota Beer Wholesalers Association, appearing with Mr. Gerbsmeyer, who, as you all know, represents the Teamsters Joint Council 32. And we're appearing this evening to express our support of those retailers that are opposing Sunday sales. And in light of the hour in your schedule, we'll defer the basis for that to our retailers. But we did want to express our opposition to this bill.
Okay. That's it. Ms. Wood? Is there a Ms. Wood? Can't. Okay. There are some questions I know up here. Like Representative Zeller, I know you have a question. Is it all right if we just kind of...
You bet, Mr. Chairman.
Thank you, sir.
Deer Beach.
Ms. Wood, please state your name and go ahead when you're ready, please.
Yes, thank you. My name is Candace Wood, and I am the manager for the City of Hutchinson for the Municipal Liquor Store. There's a couple big issues for us, for the cities, the municipal liquor stores throughout the state with this bill. One is that at this point in our sales history, we do believe that we will take 6 days worth of sales and spread them out over 7 days, and that will have a negative effect on our net profits. The cities already are struggling. We're struggling with, in Hutchinson particularly, we're struggling with the decrease in local government aid revenues. We're struggling because our revenues from zoning and planning have decreased because the construction use in our city has decreased. And we're also struggling. We have a motor vehicle department, and the revenues from motor vehicles have also gone down because of the economy and the effect on car sales. So the city council actually is looking more and more to the liquor store to replace these revenues, and it's putting more and more stress on me as a manager and my staff to manage those profits, manage those business expenses. And so we're always looking for ways to increase our sales. We're always looking for ways to increase our profits. But I don't believe that Sunday sales are going to do that. I'm afraid that Sunday sales will have a negative effect on our profits, and I just don't see that it's going to help us. I guess that's really the basis of our opposition.
Thank you, Ms. Wood. Mr. Nolan?
Mr. Chairman?
Or is there someone?
If I can,
Representative Kahn.
If I can just point out again and again that nothing in the bill would mandate opening any store on Sunday, municipal or otherwise. That's a business decision that the free market capitalistic society is able to make.
A new market capitalist. That'll bring joy to people around the table.
Could I speak to that briefly?
Ms. Woods, why don't we just...
Okay.
For the spring.
Better fight.
I'm just concerned that we'll go on for a while there. Please state your name for the record and go ahead.
I'm not Bruce Nolan. I'm Mike Hansen.
Okay.
I'm in place of Mr. Nolan.
Okay. That'll work.
Chair, committee members, thank you for listening to me. I'm just going to address the family issues in this. And we I can address that we don't think that 7 days of sale is going to translate into any more revenue. So what we're going to do is take 6 days and spread it out over 7 days. It's going to cost us more money to do business that way. We're going to have to pay our help, and our profits are going to be down. So it's, but in the family issue, I've been in the business for 22 years, and I have three kids, two grandkids, and Sunday has always been family day for us. It's the one day that we can spend as a family quality time and enjoy it, because 6 days a week in the retail business, it's hectic and unpredictable. So in everybody here has family, and they know the hectic times that it is right now. And to be able to have one day with family is very important. I know my family is thankful that we had our Sundays. And we would just hope that you would would vote against this issue on Sundays and make Sunday family day and not retail day. If you have any questions, I'm here to answer. I'm just addressing the family issues in this.
Thank you. We appreciate your comments. And I think what we'll do is hold off on questions or concerns at this point, just make sure we get all the testimony.
Thank you very much.
Thank you. And the only thing that I'd ask is as you present, come on down, present your testimony, just make sure that you try not to cover the same points that other people have made. But otherwise, if you just identify yourself and proceed.
Well, I'm Jennifer Tonsite. My family owns this liquor store. I'm representing the MLBA, most of the membership, about Sunday sales. We have not heard overwhelming calls at all for Sunday sales from our customers or for a change. Also, alcohol is not a, you need bread or milk. It's a controlled substance, so it should be regulated. It's not a grocery store item. The other thing is that if you're following Colorado, that they passed Sunday sales, and now the convenience stores and grocery stores want strong beer in the convenience stores and grocery stores, and we are strongly opposed to it. So if you start opening the doors and changing the laws, it keeps going and going. So in the issue of we don't need to stay open, if our competitors are staying open, as small businesses, we have to stay competitive. We have relationships with our customers. We have to make sure that we're doing everything. So if one store stays open, we all do it. I know it's a choice, but that's how business is. You can't afford to lose it. So thank you for your time, and I'm very against the proposal.
Thank you very much for taking the time to be here with us. Yes, sir.
Well, my name is Brian Bloom. I'm the co-owner and manager of Top 10 Wine and Spirits down in Cottage Grove. We're kind of one of those border stores that are pretty close to Prescott, as our customers, if we're not open on Sundays, they do go to Prescott. I oppose Sunday sales along with the rest of the MLBA. Obviously, for one, Sunday is my day off. I've been working 17 years in this industry, and Monday through Saturday is always in my schedule. Sunday's family day. It's when we get to go do things, and we enjoy doing it. You know, we look forward to that day to have to take the stress out of the week and everything. I've heard most of the arguments for and against all the wine for the Sunday sales, but one of the biggest reasons I hear is convenience. Well, convenience falls into different areas. Shopping for alcohol is not a family event in most families. It's not like shopping for a couch or a dishwasher. So chances are we're not going out with our family to purchase our beer. One of the main arguments that lobbyists like folks like Discus use to push Sunday sales across the nation is the convenience factor. The main reason in all actuality is money when it comes down to it. Not money for the state, not money for the citizens or off-sale liquor licensees. Instead, it's for the liquor manufacturers, and that's who's really pushing Sunday sales. They believe that with the expansion of the consumption of alcoholic beverages into Sunday and everything, you know, they'll get that the expansion of consumption. In a quote from their website, you know, denied access to at least, they feel like they're denied access to at least 7% of their customer base by not having Sunday sales. They also go on to say shoppers are more likely to buy on impulse on the weekend than they are Monday through Friday. By limiting spirit sales to Saturday only, the amount of impulse acceptable exposure tied in the distilled spirit that the customers, distilled spirit customers have is cut in half on it. We don't believe these figures to be true, as sales would simply be spread out throughout the week, as you've heard before. Greed is not a justification for Sunday sales. It's what it essentially comes down to. In a time when people work more and the American family is on the decline, the last thing that we need to do is add another day selling alcohol simply for convenience, so we can have more, so a few companies can have exposure to their product. I ask that they leave the laws the way they are. They seem to work for hardworking Minnesota families as they are. Thank you.
Thank you. Appreciate you taking the time for us. Is there anyone else that desires to be heard with respect to this House file. Representative Condon, some final comments with respect to
Senate Bill? Just a comment. There are a lot of opinions that you've just heard. Let me put one fact in. Colorado did reject the selling of strong beer in grocery stores, so it isn't this pernicious slippery slope that you go down. And I guess the data has shown from the people who keep this that we're looking at an increase in revenue. We're looking at the, except for the case of the Wisconsin stores, if you think your constituents are the Wisconsin, Iowa, South Dakota, North Dakota, and Canadian stores, everywhere surrounded on every side, then I guess you could be concerned. But nothing in this bill requires anyone to be open on Sunday or to close any day that they think is their best day to be closed. And I would urge you to pass the bill, Mr. Chairman.
Thank you, Representative Kahn. Questions or concerns? Representative Hoppe and then Representative Daly.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And Representative Kahn, you and a number of the testifiers have said that nobody's required to stay open, but it's a competitive industry. And if you got, you know, a couple of liquor stores that are in relatively close proximity to each other, I mean, I think to stay competitive, if one does it, they all have to do it.
Mr. Chairman, I stand here as a supporter of the capitalistic free enterprise system. I'm surprised, Representative Hoppe, that you would want the strong arm of the state to stand in the way of free enterprise and business.
Mr. Chair, can we adjourn before things get really out of hand? Representative Hoppe, any response to that?
I thought I was doing it for the family. I don't know.
Representative Zelli.
Listening to Representative Kahn defend the very tenets of American capitalism, which I think was a direct quote. And all serious, Mr. Chairman and Representative Kahn, you and I have worked together on a lot of booze bills, so I am sympathetic to the cause, but after listening to folks in the industry, I think we need to stick with the folks that are running the stores. And yes, as a free market capitalist, I support the cause. But in this case, the people who are in the industry have asked us, I think quite politely, to stay out of their Sunday afternoons or Sunday mornings or afternoons. So although I think it's really hard, Mr. Chairman, because I'm defending the state and she's defending capitalism.
I figured out now, if you serve long enough here, you'll hear all things. I mean, we've
got to hear that. Living together,
I can retire now.
Mr. Chairman.
Thank you, Mr. Chair.
I do not believe that there has been a position taken by the industry as a whole, and I do believe that people are divided. And as I pointed out to the chairman, as this has been on the table, more and more people have come forward saying that they would like to be open on Sunday. And again, it's a free choice.
Thank you, Representative Kahn.
If you would allow it.
Are there other questions or concerns for the author? If not, then as with all of our alcohol bills, this House File 1294 will be laid over. House File 1294 as amended will be laid over for potential inclusion in the liquor omnibus. Thank you, Representative Kahn, and thank you everybody that took the time out to share your comments with us this afternoon. Representative Saylor actually is, I told Representative Dabney we'd go to him next, but we always try to take non-committee members. So we've got Representative Saylor with House File 1648.
Mr. Chair, can I move that bill, please?
Absolutely. You're a true believer.
Absolutely.
Representative Dabney will move that House File 1648 be recommended pass and refer to the General Register. Representative Saylor.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and members, and thank you, Representative Dabney, for moving this, even though I apparently stepped in front of you. This bill is referring to e-waste, electronic waste, and the reason that we need to bring this forth this year is simply for a technical fix, because we were far too successful in the last year and a half than we ever anticipated. At any rate, and we've been generating and collecting considerably more e-waste, dead TVs, and other things of that nature than we had thought. So what's happening is we're ending up with too much material right now. The recyclers have met their goals, and the counties are ending up with vast numbers of computers and other video devices
on their hands again. So what we need to do is just have a fix with what this bill is to get us through till the end of the second program year, which is the time at which we will be reviewing everything very comprehensively in the e-waste bill. This is not that. This simply gets us to that point. I have met with the recyclers, the collectors, the counties, the manufacturers, and the retailers, and while not, no one is totally happy with this, totally unhappy with it. We have three changes. One is to adopt the national sales data, which is one thing that everyone agrees on that will help move us ahead. Another provision removes the three-year limit on how long they can store their credits. And the other one puts a cap on the percentage of credits that they can use in any one year so that we don't have vast amounts storing up. Again, we need to keep the infrastructure that's been built in place, and that is what this bill is about. So, again, not everyone's totally happy. Nobody's totally unhappy.
Thank you, Representative Saylor. Is there anyone here to testify with respect to the bill, or do you have folks? Sorry. Representative Zellis has a question.
Well, Mr. Chairman, this is the right place to say I told you so or not, but I won't. I'll just say, Representative Saylor, this is a lot of what we were talking about when government gets in the business of predicting, and I was just trying to explain to Representative David the algebraic formula that we have in the bill, and since there was supposed not supposed to be math in here, I'm just curious as to why we're, again, once we're back on the subject, why not just go with the actual data versus the prediction? And that this is a question we've had, I think, pushing 2 years now, and I just think that would be a simpler version. Then we wouldn't have to come back in 2 years yet again, because I still don't think we're going to have this fixed. I hate to say I told you so, but I don't think we'll have it fixed. But again, why not just go with the actual reported sales?
Representative Saylor?
Thank you, Mr. Chair and members. Actually, that's what adopting the national sales data will help to do. And as for the tweaks and the things that we need to do to adjust, that simply is something that we're going to have to do at the end of this program year anyway, because we didn't have a pilot project with this particular bill, and so we are using, you know, the first 2 years as that project or that pilot, and now we have to make the adjustments at the end of the year as required by law. But it has been very successful. We don't want the infrastructure to go away. All of the folks that worked on this bill worked very hard on it for a number of years. And I would like to give full credit to the algebraic portion of the bill to Representative Osmond, because that was his part. And so he deserves full credit for that. Thank you.
We can blame him because he's gone, Mr. Chair.
He drove him out of here.
Yeah.
Look what happened to you. Representative Zellis, anything further?
No, I just using national sales, the data versus the actual sales sold in Minnesota, I think is the problem. And I don't think we're going to get consensus on that. So, pass, Mr. Chairman. Thank you.
Thank you, Representative Zellers. Anybody else with questions or concerns? If not, the Representative Dabney will renew his motion that House File 1648 be recommended pass for the General Register. All in favor say aye.
Aye.
Any opposed?
No.
Seeing a few, the motion nonetheless prevails. Thank you, Representative Saylor.
Thank you.
Representative Dabney, thank you for your patience. The first one that we will do is Representative Dabney's House File 1917. Representative Dabney will move House File 1979 for potential inclusion in the Omnibus Liquor Bill.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and members. This is a simple little bill.
Aye.
And it's a good bill.
Aye.
And it simply allows a liquor store to partner with an establishment holding a wine license to conduct wine tastings on the premises of the wine license holder. It maintains all current mandates if the same tasting is conducted in the liquor store, including a requirement that the wine licensee hold Graham shop insurance.
Thank you, Representative Davin.
There's a testifier available if there are questions.
I was going to ask, are you aware of any opposition, or is there anyone here in opposition to the bill?
I was aware initially of some concerns, but my understanding is that those concerns have been abated.
Thank you, Representative Davin. Are there questions, concerns from members of the committee or anyone that desires to testify? Thank you, Representative Dabney. House File 1917 will be laid over for possible inclusion in the liquor omnibus bill. Next up is Representative Dabney's bill 914, and Representative Dabney will move adoption of the committee reports for House File 914. All in favor say aye.
Aye.
Is there any opposition? Seeing none, the motion prevails. Representative Dabney will then move House File 914 be recommended pass and refer to the Committee on Civil Justice. It is my understanding that there is an author's amendment, specifically the DE2 amendment, that is puts the bill in the shape that the author desires. It's being passed out, so we will move it, but we will hold off on voting on it until it's distributed. Representative Dabney will move the DE2 author's amendment. Representative, I'm guessing that the DE2 will pass, Representative Dabney, so if you want to speak to the bill in the fashion that that you desire to move it forward.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. If we could, I'd like to just brief preliminary remark, and then Representative Mr. Elwood in a better position to do the technical walkthrough. Just to say that the DE2 amendment represents some agreement, some consensus between the lenders and the advocates and the consumer advocates. It is a, as I wish I was, slimmer bill than the one initially introduced and passed out of my division, taking out some of the areas that the lenders had most concern with, but maintaining some good consumer protection.
Thank you, Representative Dabney. Representative Elwood, I almost...
You're doing it now.
Yeah. Mr. Elwood, welcome back.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. Ron Elwood with Legal Aid. I'll briefly walk you through what this does now. And I, first of all, I'd like to thank Mr. Pender for getting this amendment done really quickly. We had some discussions with the industry today, so he did a great job. And I think we also want to thank the members of the industry who worked with us to get to the place where we are today. And I think that they're okay with it. So, and I'll tell you what it does. The Section 1 is pretty technical. It just includes Section 4760 lenders in the reporting requirements that we, additional ones that are part of this bill. And Section 2 deals with some of the violations from 4760. The guts of the bill are in Section 3. And what we do here is apply the protections that are in this bill to both to lenders who are lending under both 4760 and 4759. There are two categories of payday lenders in Minnesota, one lending under one section, the other lending under the other. This puts them all in one for these particular purposes. And the main points of this bill, it's subdivision 2 starting on page 3, put some provisions on what the contract has to say. Section subdivision 3 on page 3, line 24, applies Minnesota debt collection protections to payday lenders collecting their own debts. As you may know, debt collection laws under the state and federal government only apply to third-party collectors. These would apply those provisions to first-party collectors. Subdivision 4 makes it prohibits payday lenders from criminally prosecuting payday lending borrowers from writing a bad check, because the nature of the business is you're essentially writing a bad check. You're writing a check for funds you don't have in your account today, and actually under Section 609.535, that's theft, and that's not the intent. So that eliminates that problem. Subdivision 5 adds some reporting requirements, and Subdivision 6 is probably the most important part of the bill, and that sweeps in the internet lenders being subject to Minnesota law. And Section 7 is our enforcement. Section 7, 8, and 9 are enforcement sections.
Thank you, Mr. Elwood. And we appreciate when we get a delete all in this fashion. It's nice, even though it's been through the division, to have a good walkthrough. So we appreciate that. Representative Dabney, any further comments? Or are you aware of anyone else that desires to testify?
I am not. I am now. Mr. Cassidy.
That's nothing like having folks standing next to you going.
Welcome. Peripheral vision.
Yes. Welcome back.
Mr. Chairman, Paul Cassidy with Leonard Street & Tynard on behalf of Payday America. I'll keep this brief. This does represent discussions that we've been having with Mr. Elwood and Representative Dabney. I think we're moving towards some type of agreement. We hope to bring closure to this. We'll keep working on it for the next 48 hours as we approach the end of the week and deadlines. And with that, I'll leave it at that. I think it does start to get to some of the issues that we agree and we've agreed from, I think, day one need to be addressed in the payday lending industry, specifically the internet abuses that go on that I think make a lot of the good businesses in Minnesota look bad. So I'll leave it at that. And if you have any questions, I'd be happy for questions. Thank you.
Thank you. Are there questions? Representative David.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Maybe this is to Pender. I think Mr. Elwood said, and Mr. Cassidy referred to it, about regulating the internet. To Mr. Pender, can we do that?
Mr. Pender?
Mr. Chair, it depends on a variety of factors. This bill is set up so that if you read it there on page... On page 4, about the middle of the page on jurisdiction, this is limited to situations where the company is dealing with a Minnesota resident and the borrower completes the transaction either personally or electronically, that's the internet part of it, while physically located in the state of Minnesota.
Representative Davis.
Well, Mr. Chairman, Mr. Pender, can we do that?
Yes.
Thank you. I mean, seriously.
Mr. Pender.
Mr. Chair and Representative Davids, this is a tough area of law and a growing area of law. And I can't give a 100% opinion on it, but I think there'd be a strong argument here given the way this is written.
Mr. Chairman, is there a strong argument, yay or nay?
A strong argument, yay.
Oh, thank you.
Representative Hoppe, did you have a question?
I'd like Representative David to
answer. Representative Bellers.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman, and maybe for the author. Are there any interest rate restrictions in here at all? I don't think there are. Okay. Then, Mr. Chair,
for the record, they nodded no. They shook their head no.
United with them right there.
Well, I do.
Okay.
Representative Zeller?
Yes, that's March made for radio, Mr. Chairman. I nodded right along with them. And then just the other question is, moving on to Representative Mueller's committee, correct, Mr. Chair?
That is my
staff is nodding.
Understanding is that it is going to the Committee on Civil
Affairs. And thank you to the Chair of the Earth of the author for continuing to work on the bill.
Representative Anders.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Representative Dabney, can you repeat the criminal prosecution piece of this, what that means?
Representative Dabney?
Mr. Chair, Representative Anderson, I can paraphrase Mr. Elwood's point that the essence of this industry is I write you a check for which I do not have funds. If I had funds, I wouldn't be borrowing the money. So acceptance of that check by the lender is not a criminal act on the part of the borrower. It's an exemption to the usual statute that says if I'm writing you a bad check, I'm a bad person and I'm going to get slapped. This provides an exception because that is the business model.
And we didn't vote on the DE2 amendment. That's the author's amendment that we've been discussing. All in favor of the amendment, say aye.
Aye.
Any opposed? Seeing none, that puts the bill as amended before us. Are there other questions or concerns? Otherwise, Representative Abney will renew his motion that House File 914 as amended be recommended to pass and refer to the Committee on Civil Justice. All in favor, say aye.
Aye.
Any opposed?
No.
The motion prevails. Thank you. You missed the memo. The Dabney vote counts as 5. So there was it's that math stuff that you guys are trying to avoid. Thank you, Representative Dabney.
Algebra.
Let's see. We have House File 120. Representative Hosh, are you ready to roll? Representative Hosh will move that House File 120 be recommended to pass and re-referred to the Committee on Civil Justice. Representative Hosh, your bill.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, members of the committee.
House File 120 provides for Department of Health oversight over the Minnesota Rural Health Cooperative to make sure that there are no anti-competitive effects happening from their ability to represent member clinics, hospitals, and specialist clinics in their area. Just a little bit of background. The state of Minnesota in 1994 passed the Minnesota Healthcare Cooperative Act, and the goal of this act was to contain healthcare costs, improve the quality of healthcare, and increasing the access of Minnesota citizens to healthcare services. This bill, the Minnesota Rural Health Cooperative, was established in 1995 in response to this legislation, and they represent 23 critical access hospitals. And if you are unaware of what a critical access hospital is, it's a critical access hospital serves a significantly underserved area in the state of Minnesota. And they also represent 24 primary care physicians and 10 specialty clinics. The Minnesota Rural Health Cooperative, I believe, provides access to health care in the parts of rural Minnesota. They are actually located in Representative Seifert's district. He's a co-author of this bill along with me, and he wished he could be here today, but he is spending the evening with his wife because it is her birthday. But Representative Seifert does have a letter in support, and that's included in the packet that was handed out. I believe it's under tab 20.
Oh, I'm sorry, Representative Hosh, Mrs. Seifert sent a letter saying she'd prefer that she spend her birthday without Representative Seifert. So he may actually be joined. I'm just kidding.
Mr. Chair,
that's
tried.
A good place for him to be.
Mr. Chair, I tried, but I am not. Representative Seifert isn't easily convinced of my position on some things. But
thank you, Representative Hosh.
And with that said, though, I would like to hand it over to individuals from the Minnesota Rural Health Cooperative that can address any of your concerns and also provide additional testimony in what they do.
Very good. You're looking around like, oh, they're gone. But they're welcome to the committee. You could just identify yourself for the record and proceed with your testimony.
Hi, my name is Chuck Ness. I'm the CEO of the Minnesota Rural Health Cooperative. I'm obviously in support of the bill. We've been in operation since 1995. We felt things were going well with the health plans, had good relationships with them. So I guess we're interested in having this continue. That's all we're asking. I'd like to turn it over, if I could, to David Balto, our attorney, has a statement to talk about. I'll be here for questions.
Very good. Thank you, Mr. Ness. Mr. Balto, welcome to the committee.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman and members of the committee. I'm David Balto. I'm an antitrust lawyer in Washington. I've spent the majority of my career as a public servant. I was the policy director of the Federal Trade Commission. I'm also a senior fellow at the Center for American Progress, where I work on health care reform issues. I'm here with a simple message for you. What the what is sought in this legislation is a relatively simple change, which is necessary for the health care cooperatives in Minnesota to continue to function. Let me start with two simple facts. As documented in numerous studies, rural health care has faced a chronic shortage of providers. That's why the Minnesota State Legislature and other state legislatures in the 1990s passed legislation to provide for co-ops to be formed, that provided for co-ops to have the ability to collectively negotiate on behalf of their members. Have no doubt about it. If this legislation isn't passed, insurance companies will be able to cram down take-it-or-leave-it contracts on providers. Some of those providers are going to go out of business. Some of those critical access healthcare hospitals will be back here asking for more money from the state. Second, the focus of the Federal Trade Commission is solely on prices. That is, that insurance companies not pay too much. But the Minnesota legislature rightfully looked beyond price in deciding whether or not firms can act cooperatively. After all, Minnesota is the home of cooperatives. There are over almost 1,000 cooperatives in Minnesota that permit business people and farmers to form together to act collectively. Minnesota is making the choice that economic opportunity and access are more important than simply the question of how much somebody gets paid. By the way, there's testimony that my testimony has been handed out to you. Now to the FTC letter. First, it's important to note when this legislation was passed, The FTC did not complain. The Minnesota Attorney General did not complain. Nobody came before you and said, wait, we don't want these cartels formed. We think this is wrong. The FTC never objected. Second, the proposed legislation doesn't create an a new antitrust exemption. It's always existed. It's existed for the last 15 years. All we're saying is we want to strengthen the policeman on the beat. The policeman on the beat is the Minnesota Department of Health. Let's have the Minnesota policeman on the beat review it more carefully. Third, the FTC fails to recognize the pro-competitive benefits of the Minnesota Healthcare Cooperative. At the time these co-ops were organized, there were two chronic problems in rural Minnesota areas. Look at the letter in your material from Congressmen Peterson and Walz, which detailed these problems. First, rural markets were dominated by Blue Cross Blue Shield. There was no other alternative. Second, the insurers refused to negotiate with doctors and hospitals, and that exacerbated the shortage of doctors. Now, look at that letter from Congressman Peter and Walz. What it tells you is the success of the Minnesota Rural Health Co-op and other co-ops. They increased access by enabling the co-op to provide services for its members, which then enabled providers to stay in the market and then go and provide greater choice. In addition, it facilitated the entry of other insurance companies. One may wonder why those insurance companies over here are here complaining about the merger. Maybe it is that they don't really like things that facilitate new entry into the market. Now let me deal with my friends at the FTC. If you leave this table, there's one message I want to get across to you. I used to write these letters for the FTC. I know that legislatures looking at the complete public interest, not just the question of prices, have rejected FTC letters like this over and over again. And I have the highest respect for the people at the FTC. Let's deal with this specific complaint. 14 years, first they say, this will lead to higher prices. How do they tell you will lead on higher prices? They tell you about two cases, one in 1988, one in 1992, two cases from the state of New York. They tell you about these studies done about a national exemption for all doctors. Do they tell you about Minnesota? No. Do they tell you that consumers have suffered because of the actions of the co-op? No. Do they tell you there's been less access or higher prices because of the co-op's activity? No. If the best evidence of the impact of the co-op is what has happened over the last 14 years, and the best thing to look for on that is the material that has been provided to you, especially the letters from Congressman Peterson and Walz. Now the FTC, second, the FTC says this isn't necessary. If any of these co-ops want to collectively negotiate, we have these guidelines you can use. So let me tell you the reality about those guidelines. There's a limited exception that says that if doctors clinically integrate, they can collectively negotiate. You know what it costs to clinically integrate? First, you have to come to a lawyer like me, and I'll charge you $100,000 to get through the FTC process. Second, you're going to have to bring together 300 or 400 doctors.
That's per hour, just so we're clear.
You'll have to bring together several hundred doctors, and the cost of implementing something like this is $1 million. Now, who's going to pay that for that $1 million? It's going to be the consumers in rural Minnesota. You've got an efficient, low-cost cooperative system, just like every other co-op you've got in this country. That's better than adopting the FTC's model. The FTC then suggests that this will reduce quality and access to care. Again, look at Congressman Peterson's letter. Is that borne out by the facts? No, by enabling the members to collectively negotiate, they're staying in the market, providing greater access. Indeed, the co-op goes and provides quality review services for the insurance companies that the insurance companies value. The co-op provides credentialing services that the insurance companies value. The co-op has a complaint system. So if you have a problem with a provider, the co-op finds out about it and goes and deals with it. Are the protections in the legislation sufficient? Well, the FTC folks obviously haven't talked to the people at the Minnesota Department of Health. they suggest that, well, there's that these provisions providing greater supervision aren't sufficient. Well, we've talked to those people, and we know states, and this legislation really follows models that the state legislature has used in Minnesota before, that other state legislatures have used. Finally, the FTC suggests this will make health care reform more difficult. I, as a member of CAP, as a member of, I'm involved in the administration's health care reform effort. And what the administration is particularly looking for are innovative delivery systems such as health care co-ops. They're going to be key to providing health care reform. As a former FTC official, I have the greatest degree of admiration for my former agency. But here the comments of the agency have just missed the boat. These markets are unique, and they fail to grapple with the unique aspects of the market. You were right in enacting this statute 14 years ago. You should go and amend the statute to provide the appropriate level of supervision so this co-op can, and other co-ops can continue to exist.
Thank you, Mr. Balto. And thank you, Mr. Neff.
Well, we have two other people with us, right? Dr. Alan Ross.
Mr. Neff. Why don't we see if there's opposition to it? Because I'm guessing that there may well be a little bit of that, and then we'll see what kind of questions or concerns that people have and go from there.
All right, thank you.
Is there anybody in opposition to House File 120? Come on down. You're the next testifier on the Commerce and Labor Committee. If you just identify yourself for the record and proceed with your testimony.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. My name is Tom Purcell. I'm a partner at the Lindquist and Benham Law Firm. I've been practicing healthcare antitrust law in this state for over 23 years, most of that time as the former person in charge of the state antitrust division under Attorney General Humphrey. I now am here as the antitrust counsel to the Minnesota Council of Health Plans. I'd also like to say that as a lawyer in private practice and as a law enforcer, I've been involved in any number of cases involving groups of providers collectively negotiating with buyers. And let me just state the obvious for everybody in the committee. People don't collectively bargain for lower prices. They collectively bargain for higher prices. And this bill, if it encourages, if it permits the same kind of activity that continues, it will lead to higher prices here in Minnesota. I also, among other things, was instrumental in helping to negotiate the original Chapter 62R provision, the Minnesota Rural Healthcare Cooperative Law, back in 1995. I'll tell you that law was intended to enable and facilitate certain kinds of cooperative activities which are perfectly pro-competitive and which are perfectly efficient, and Mr. Balto mentioned a number of them. Joint credentialing, joint quality programs, joint complaint programs, all of these things are perfectly pro-competitive. They're the kinds of things that were in the spirit of the original bill and which do not need an antitrust exemption. You probably all have before you now or have had an opportunity to see the Federal Trade Commission's letter opposing this legislation. The Federal Trade Commission, in my experience and a long experience of both working with them on healthcare antitrust cases and with the Justice Department as well, I have to tell you that they are very careful and cautious about what they say in public about and the positions that they take. So you have before you a letter which, if anything, understates the gravity of the anti-competitive and adverse impact that this bill will have. I will tell you that the Federal Trade Commission says that this bill will, and this is explicit in the letter, will raise prices and health care costs for all consumers, not just health plans, but also individual consumers, government buyers, employers and patients. And while the Federal Trade Commission may make that kind of a prediction based on its vast experience in this kind of legislation, I can tell you as a representative of the health plan that this is not a theoretical concern. For example, the kind of negotiating activity that takes place and would take place if this bill were to sanction it, it is like the following. A representative of one of the health plans was recently negotiating with members of the Minnesota Rural Healthcare Cooperative. They went into a room before the negotiations started. These are competing hospitals and clinics, mind you. Decided what their prices were going to be. Came out and made a demand, including a demand for, in some cases, for 100% of billed charges for the hospitals. And told the health plan negotiators that demand was essentially non-negotiable. That if the individual members did not get the prices that they wanted, that there was a serious threat of that none of the members of the healthcare cooperative would do business with them. This is a classic price-fixing boycott, and it is a violation of the antitrust laws, and the FTC letter expressly recognizes that what you are being asked to sanction with this bill is price fixing. Now, you might think, to listen to Mr. Balto, that the effects of this have been benign, this cooperative. I will tell you that in the experience of the health plans, given the current negotiations, that the clinics in this area actually currently make 140% reimbursement as compared to their peers in other comparable areas and regions of the state. So they already make 40% more. That is not, they're not dying on the vine. They make more money than their peers in other areas. Members, I also must tell you that some of the hospitals who continue to demand 100% of billed charges, which nobody gets in a discount healthcare environment, also have told everyone that they expect to get up to 33% increases in their reimbursements by virtue of joining this cooperative. And that as they become eligible to participate in the joint negotiations, they also have been demanding increases of between 22 and 66% over their previous reimbursement. This bill will drive health care costs up for everybody, and the health plans not only have that, this isn't a theoretical concern, it is the actual experience of the health plans. I want to point out a couple of other features of the Federal Trade Commission's letter and also of things that I think are extremely material for you to consider in your role as protectors of consumers. The Federal Trade Commission expressly says that the kind of oversight that is provided in this bill will not adequately protect consumers. Will not adequately protect consumers. And the reason is that the process is not extensive enough. There actually is a clear precedent for this kind of statute here in Minnesota. In 1993, the Minnesota legislature enacted a previous antitrust exemption process. That process, which was in Chapter 62J.2911 through .21, was far more extensive. If you want to see what kind of a process would really adequately protect consumers, look at the old bill. Because
Mr. Purcell, this is, you know, that yellow light, you know, green light, yellow light. So the red light is starting to turn orange right now.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I
can say lawyer to lawyer. You know what I'm talking about, right?
I fully appreciate that. I can see the Chief Justice breathing down my neck even as we speak. And for the same reason, I just want to make one other important point, and that is that this bill will not confer the kind of federal law antitrust immunity that the authors are seeking. In order to get that kind of immunity, you need both a legislative intent and active supervision. And under Subdivision 2 of this bill, there are scenarios where an application for collective bargaining could be approved without any supervision whatsoever. And then one final point, if the chair will indulge me for a second, I think this bill will cost the state money in two ways. You will not only pay more for health insurance for people, but it is, I think it's impossible for the Department of Health to do a real review the economic consequences of any arrangement for the $2,000 application fee that's provided herein, and that it would be a far more extensive review and staff review by MDH would be necessary. Thank you very much.
Thank you, Mr. Purcell. And at this point, I think what I'd like to do is see if members have questions or concerns. We'll still continue to take further testimony to the extent that it addresses questions or concerns from members. Representative Hoppe?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. For this testifier or for any, I had a question for Mr. Balto. Do you want him to come back?
Yeah.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And Mr. Balto, when I'm looking at your testimony that you provided us today, and looking at the letter from the FTC, in your testimony you refer, and in your oral testimony you refer to the letter from Congressman Peterson and Walz, and I look in here and that testimony or that letter was dated January 9, 2008. The letter we have in front of us from the FTC is March 18, 2009. So what I would gather, and I'm not an attorney, but what I would gather from that is that either the letter from the congressman is outdated, or the FTC had that and rejected it.
I think we're dealing with two different things. What the congressmen were seeking was for the FTC to give the co-op the permission to go and seek an amendment to the statute to provide for active supervision. The key to Congressman Walz and Peterson's letter, though, are their observations. Their observations as representing the people of Minnesota of the effect of the co-op. And those observations are, you know, I think still true now.
Representative Hoppe.
Mr. Chair, thank you. And Mr. Balto, with all due respect, their observations are, you're putting their observations in their letter for it in support of this bill. The FTC is, from what I read here, opposed to this legislation.
Well, what the FTC is consistently opposes any kind of legislation of this kind. And if you carefully look at their letter, you'll see that the first page deals with Minnesota. The last couple pages deal with Minnesota. The rest of the middle is basically what they say in every case. The real thing, but...
Well, Mr. Chair?
Representative Hoppe.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Mr. Balto, you're telling us that this is such an important bill that we have two of our esteemed United States congressmen that support it and put forward that letter as being a reason that the FTC should have supported this bill and they didn't. It's your ball, Bill.
Yes, I mean, the ultimately, you know, you have to make a decision of, remember, the FTC's focus is different than your focus and responsibility as state legislators. The FTC is just the limited question of whether or not, you know, will insurance companies conceivably have to pay more? The responsibility, the public interest is a much broader public interest than that. Representative Hoppe.
Well, thank you, Mr. Chair. Mr. Balto, I'm just responding to your testimony when you brought up the letter from the congressman as support for the bill and made sure that we understood that that went to the FTC.
Yes, they did go to, it did go to the FTC. And
and we still have the letter from the FTC opposing this bill.
Right, and there are times when state legislatures choose, many times when state legislatures choose not to follow the advice of the FTC because the public interest is different than the interest represented in that letter.
Okay. Representative David.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And Mr. Balto, on the third page, there's a six here that on the top of the page. And then it's a footnote, and it says, we have asked the MRHC representatives to notify the relevant legislative committees that their prior representations of FTC staff views were not accurate. Can I get a copy of that letter?
Oh, certainly.
Mr. Balto? Mr. Balto. Hello? Hi. Can you kind of come through me? I mean, I'm not a big...
I apologize.
It's just really kind of nice. And just kind of slow down and let's play nice here, so.
Mr. Chairman.
Mr. David.
And Mr. Balto, what is that letter talking about that the staff views were not accurate?
Mr. Balto.
Thank you. My understanding is that in some past hearings that there may have been a suggestion made that the FTC would oppose their investigation if this legislation was passed, and it really wasn't appropriate. It was a mistake, but it really wasn't appropriate for someone other than the FTC to express the FTC's point of view.
Well, Representative Davis.
Mr. Chairman, thank you, Mr. Chairman. Mr. Balto, if you could provide me the copy of that, I'd appreciate it. Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
Thank you very much. Any further questions from members? Representative Hosh.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and members of the committee. I greatly appreciate your time. I want to make this absolutely clear. This legislation does not change in any way the current practices of the Minnesota Rural Health Cooperative or how they practice in the last 13 years since they incorporated the response to the 1994 legislation that passed the House of Representatives. I think we know access is an issue in rural Minnesota. If it weren't, I think we'd have primary care physicians throughout our state and we wouldn't have a shortage. If the numbers are so inflated as were suggested when it came to reimbursement, I don't think you'd have the challenges that rural Minnesota is seeing when it comes to access and delivery of health care. There are other cooperatives in the state of Minnesota that we have all decided as a legislature are beneficial. We have cooperatives in the production and in the distribution of energy. We have cooperatives in the agriculture sector, and we have found them to be beneficial in serving our constituents and our communities well. I believe the Minnesota Rural Health Cooperative does the same. This legislation will simply provide greater oversight and I believe greater protection of Minnesota. I think it's illogical to link a lot of the claims in the FTC letter to what this legislation does. If you read House File 120, it provides oversight, it provides protection, and ensuring that the efficiencies of service out of the Minnesota Rural Health Cooperative outweigh any other negative effects. I would appreciate the committee's support of this. And to go back to the goals that are expressly written in the 1994 legislation that authorized Minnesota Health Cooperative, it is the goal of containing health care costs, improving quality of health care, and increasing the access of Minnesota citizens to health care services. And I think this legislation will continue us to reach that goal, and I would appreciate the support.
Thank you, Representative Posh. With that, Representative Posh renews his motion that House File 120 be recommended to pass and re-referred to the Committee on Civil Justice. All those in favor say aye.
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 Those opposed?
No.
The bill is passed. On your way, sir. And thank you for doing a favor for our esteemed minority leader. So we want to make sure he has a stable home so he can lead the troops on that side of the aisle. Representative Polk. Representative Falk, the chair will move that your bill is as amended is back 357 is back before us for reconsideration. So Representative Falk.
And thank you, Mr. Chair and members. Just want to make sure I believe the motion was to refer to pass to finance with referral back to energy. Is that the motion that we have?
Representative Falk, your journey will take you to finance and then refer then to the Committee on Energy and Policy. And
thank you, Mr. Chair.
Representative Falk, just to kind of give a well, Chair Atkins will probably take over. But I believe we've had quite a bit of testimony already, and so I don't know if we want to. Maybe we had quite a few questions lined up, so maybe why don't you want to make an opening statement, and or do you just want to start questions? Why don't you go ahead with a brief opening statement?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Good to be back before the committee, and I want to clear up some details. This is a bill that deals with standardized contracts for community-based energy development projects, which are locally owned projects dealing with renewable energy resources. And there's really two parts to the bill. One, we're establishing a standardized contract based on language which was created 1997 a distributed generation contract for 2 megawatt and less projects. We're directing the PUC to go and apply that standard contract to larger projects, to work with stakeholders to go and figure out a way to make this process work better. And the other part is creating a smaller contract with for projects less than 5 megawatts to help our cities, our counties, our schools, our local farmers, business owners, to have a way to get involved with these renewable energy resources. And we're using the average price of the entire MISO Minnesota hub from the previous year, discounted appropriately at the purchasing utilities discount rate. So we are actually using a market-derived price to come up with the contract. And the reason why this is important is the standard contract is because in the federal stimulus package, there are a number of incentive programs available that help facilitate renewable energy projects, but in order to qualify for some of these programs, specifically the parts in the American Recovery and Reinvestment Act, the projects have to be in the ground and operating by December 31st, 2010. And so we need a standard contract and we need the mechanisms to facilitate the development of these projects. What we're doing is we're asking the PUC, Public Utilities Commission, to find a way to direct projects of that nature spread equally through the utilities service, among how much they're served proportionally, to find a way to develop 200 megawatts of projects by then. It's a way for us to further our ability to benefit from the stimulus package. I think there's been some hang-up on that part, but once again, we're talking about a very small portion of the overall energy needs of the state of Minnesota when we're looking at between 15,000 and 16,000 total megawatts of energy coming into the state. I know we've been here for a long time. I want to keep my comments brief and allow people to ask questions.
Well, you went by brief about 5 minutes ago, but we appreciate your comments, Representative Paul. We did have testimony on both sides of the bill the other day. I want to get the members' concerns or questions. To the extent we need folks to come and answer those questions, we'll call upon them. But are there questions, comments from members of the committee? Seeing none, the chair will renew his motion. No? There's one or two?
Yeah.
Based on the smile, Representative Zellers, we'll go to you.
Well, thanks, Mr. Chair. And Representative Falk, first, maybe just to start with the antitrust issue. There's all kinds of warts all over this, but let's just start with the biggest and the worst one. We've heard from some of the testifiers. Everybody, I think, in our office has had someone come in and say, "Here, this is a severe violation of the interstate, antitrust, interstate commerce by what you're doing here." And I guess I can't understand how you can present a bill like that.
Representative Falk.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Representative Zellers. I guess with the amended language, we're requiring projects, and once again, people get hung up on these smaller projects, but we're saying that you have to go and do a number of these projects which qualify for an incentive, whether it be federal or other incentive. And furthermore, this is nothing new. The state's done this number of times. I can reference Statute 216B.2423, the original mandate that was put in place with the first Prairie Island that required any utility operating a nuclear facility in the state to first develop 225 megawatts of wind, an additional 200 megawatts after that. This has been a process that's been used before, and if it wasn't hung up then, I don't see how it is being hung up now. The state, through the fact that our utilities are regulated, has the ability to direct how resources are procured, how those resources, electricity is generated. And so this is not a new thing. We're just further expanding this to say, when you're looking at your resource plans, we're requiring you to find some of these smaller projects to help reinvest in the communities to allow local ownership in the area where these projects are being developed. Currently, in southwestern Minnesota, we have three counties where there's been a large amount of development, Lincoln, Pipestone, and Rock counties, where $100 million a year of gross revenue leaves those counties. That's a problem for our rural parts of the state where they're not able to benefit from this new renewable energy economy.
Well, Mr. Chairman,
Representative Ellis,
maybe I'll try again. So if someone who supplies us with energy wants to purchase energy from a seabed program that's not in the state of Minnesota, they would not be allowed to do that under your bill, yes or no?
Representative Ellis, thank you, Mr. Chair. I believe if you go to the bill and you read the amended language, on 1.25, this requirement shall not prevent a public utility from developing or acquiring electrical energy from other sources, either within or outside the state, regardless of whether such resources, whether such sources use renewable energy. I believe that should take care of your concerns there.
Representative Zeller, does that take care of your concerns?
No, well, I don't think so, Mr. Chairman, but the point that you made about the Minnesota only project under the scenario we heard about, I think it was last week, where you're concerned about staying in rural Minnesota and the jobs and the money and the projects being focused there. We heard from one of the testifiers that I could be sitting on my deck in Minnetonka if I wasn't, not that I have a deck in Minnetonka, but I could buy these projects, have them out there in greater Minnesota, not ever live out there, move out there, be out there, and then profit from this, the rate that you set in here to the tune of, you know, $2, $3, $4 million more if I just buy five little projects at 5 megawatts or less. I don't understand how that's, I guess I understand that the project is out there, but from a rural standpoint, aren't we just going to make some rich guys here richer?
Representative Paul?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Representative Zeller, I do not believe that is the case. We do have a list of qualifying owners in the current seabed statute, but to reference your person from Minnetonka, unless they own property out there, they'd have to go and work with the local landowner to be able to develop a project. And what we're putting in place is a tool to allow local landowners to have a fair share at the bargaining table.
Representative Zeller, anything further at this point?
Yeah, well, Mr. Chair, so I'm a local landowner out there. I sell a couple of acres to the rich guy from Minnetonka. He's now a local landowner. Isn't the scenario I just presented exactly what would happen?
Representative Falk?
Mr. Chair, Representative Zeller, the qualifying owners in the seabed statute, you do have to be, I can't remember the entire list, but a Minnesota resident, a Minnesota qualified business, nonprofit. It could be a local unit of government such as a city. It could be a school. The idea here is we want to make sure that these businesses, these projects are owned by Minnesotans. Right now, most of them are owned by either foreign multinational companies or national companies, i.e. Florida Power and Light, Iberdrola, Inexco, PTM, Edison Mission Group. We have a large amount of money that's being generated in this state to serve Minnesota ratepayers that is flowing out of state. That is the problem, and we need to address that because we have such an opportunity to reinvest in some of these rural parts of the state and to ensure that Minnesota businesses, which are paying Minnesota taxes, have a fair share donating the resources in addition to local farmers or the school or the county or the city. This is a mechanism to help them. Currently, I believe the number is about 85% of the wind turbines in this state are owned by entities not headquartered or not businesses from this state.
Representative Zeller?
Mr. Chair, I think that my rich guy in Minnetonka still qualifies, but I'll let that go. But so the guy in Minnetonka, and it's a pro-Minnetonka business guy, but also a pro-fencing bill. So I'll come back to more questions afterwards, Mr. Chairman, because I do want to have the interstate commerce issue revisited, because I don't think the author of the bill is correct on that. But I'll defer some other questions from other members, Mr. Chair.
Are there other questions? Representative David?
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. A couple things here. First of all, I believe that the Isaac Walton League, the environmental group, testified in opposition to this bill. And the day that Phyllis Kahn, Representative Kahn, is a free market capitalist is the day I'm a rabid environmentalist. But we certainly...
You're a rabid environmentalist? Is that what I should write down?
Mr. Chairman, I'm supporting the Isaac Walton League. So. And last week I supported the ACLU on the Real ID Act, and I just don't know what's happening. That being said, you know, with the provision in here about, you know, removing the language at minimal impact to customer rates is quite frightening. I think there's an amendment to address that later, but maybe it's more of a statement than a question. To go from, we had testimony earlier that this could raise the rates up to $93, and we have from Minnesota Rural Electric Association wind project at $50 to $55, and you can go with ultra clean coal for about $30. To consider raising our electrical rates from $30 or $50 to $93 is to me just outrageous. And that's coming from someone who has a pretty good track record on renewable fuels and wind, and writing with my good friend, God rest his soul, Senator Sam from Staples. The E-20 bill, which I took a lot of heat in from my caucus and others, I think I've got a pretty good track record on renewable fuels. But this going from $30 or $50 to $93, I just can't imagine that this legislature should support that, Mr. Chairman.
Thank you, Representative Davids. I've got Representative Simon and then Representative Anfeld, Representative Hoppe. And I'm, folks, just sort of a map of where we're going, I'm hoping to take a vote one way or the other at about 7:15. We got two bills remaining, and then we'll be finished up for the evening. So Representative Simon, then Anfeld.
Just a quick point on the Commerce Clause issue, Mr. Chair. I just want to clarify, because you read a portion of the new language and I didn't catch what it was, but are you saying that right now there's no Minnesota-only restriction?
Representative Falk?
Mr. Chair, Representative Simon, that is the what we're saying, is we're saying that a utility can go and do projects, what they have in the process, but we're also saying in addition to what they're currently doing, they have to go and do 200 megawatts worth of small projects which qualify for some form of an incentive. That's in addition to what they have for their current plans. We're not halting, we're not impeding, we're not slowing down their other projects. We're just saying, in addition, you must do 200 megawatts of these smaller projects, which will qualify for some form of incentive.
But is there a geographic, thank you, Mr. Chair, is there a geographic restriction on that?
Mr. Chair.
Representative Paul?
That would be a project located in Minnesota, which is, once again, nothing that we haven't done before, referencing back to the original Prairie Island requirements that Xcel Energy purchased X amount of megawatts of wind power to offset their nuclear gas storage.
Representative Simon, you?
Yeah.
Good. Representative Anfeld?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I listened intently to the question and the response from the author, Representative Zellers, of your first question. And perhaps I can give you an analogy which may help. From about 1890 to the mid-50s and early 60s, companies from Pittsburgh and Cleveland exploited Minnesota's natural resource called iron ore. And we got very little in return. They built museums and schools and universities and hospitals in Pittsburgh and Cleveland, and all we got were shacks next to the mine. Then a guy by the name of Davis, a Minnesota entrepreneur at the University of Minnesota, invented the taconite process. We convinced the companies that this was the continuation of their business, and we taxed them. And we continue to tax them, and we continue to benefit, and we continue to benefit as a state rather than to benefit as a state rather than to have Pittsburgh and Cleveland benefit exclusively. That's what this legislation will do. It'll allow entrepreneurs and investors and developers from Minnesota to get in on this great renewable energy business. I don't know why anybody in these economic times couldn't support that, at least conceptually.
Representative Zellers, you want to take that up? All right, Representative Hoppe will.
Go ahead.
That'd be my guess anyway.
No, well, go ahead.
Mr. Chair and Representative Andros, I have no problem with that. My problem is that we're going to put it to the ratepayers. And if it's a good idea, then it should be able to stand on its own. Representative Davids, close your ears. A lot of what we said with some of the ethanol subsidies, with a number of the government subsidies, we said if it's a good idea, stand on its own. And if we're going to put this on the backs of the ratepayers, we're putting in the law a set price, where if you, Representative Anzelks, cut the deal today, we heard in testimony, you just hurt yourself to the tune of $200,000-$400,000 because you set the price today. Under this bill, we're going to give you the price going forward. We're going to tell you the price going forward. Now, again, I have no problem, but if we're going to fence off the state of Minnesota, That, we've tried that too. And if you're going to fence it off and say no one else can ever come in and get any other projects in the state, it all has to be locally, we tried that too, and that doesn't work so well either. All I'm concerned about, Representative Van Zelt, is the ratepayers, because that's who's going to end up paying the bill on this thing. And to the overall argument, this is a process that we put in place, no offense to the author of the bill, long ago, and now we're not even, we've tiptoed into the program. The folks that were demanding do this have been, are actually ahead of the game, and now, just like the federal government, we're going to come in and say, ollie, ollie, oxen free, we're changing the rules on you. We got a 20-year project.
What was that again?
Ollie, ollie, oxen free.
Okay, thank you.
These are with the Dabney bill, too, and mortgages, but
I just wanted to make sure we were clear what we were saying.
Oh. Hey, I'm defending the state today, and Tom's the raving capitalist, so it's dogs and cats are living together. But Representative Angelos, that's all I'm concerned about, is that we're going to put it on the ratepayers. And again, if you're going to set up a deal, then move by the deal you set up 2 years ago. Don't change it halfway in, no offense to the author, whether or not it's a good idea or not. Because now, who's ever going to trust us on a deal?
Representative Hoppe will. Representative Hoppe?
Mr. Chair, before we get too far forward, I don't know if there's been a request for a roll call.
I requested one.
Okay, thank you, Mr.
Representative Hoppe.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And I want to go back for a minute to Representative Simon's comment and the answer from the author. When I was noticing that we had somebody in the audience, Mr. Crocker, who was rather vigorously shaking his head no when we were getting an answer from the author. I don't know if we want to encourage more testimony at this point, but I have a number of questions about the community in CDED, and it seems there was at least some indication of discrepancy on where we are with that.
Well, if you'd like to ask directly of Mr. Crocker, we're happy to do that. I will emphasize, though, I still plan on taking a vote on this in a few minutes. So, Mr. Crocker, you want to come on down? We don't want to have any discrepancies.
No, nope, Mr. Chair, and I will be brief. And Mr. Crocker, I'll just ask, when I was looking at Representative Simon when at his question and the author's answer, and you were sitting right behind Representative Simon shaking your head no, and I'm just wondering what's going on.
Crocker?
Mr. Chairman, Representative Hoppe, as I recall, the question had to do with whether or not the requirement for 200 megawatts needs to be located in the state of Minnesota. Is that a correct rephrasal of the question?
I believe so.
Representative Hoppe, Mr. Crocker.
Mr. Chairman, Representative Hoppe, if I could direct you, please, to author's amendment 88, beginning on line 1.16, which is the language that requires the 200 megawatts. You will see that on line 1.20. You will see nothing in that paragraph that requires any of that power to be purchased in any specific place. If you want to buy it from Hawaii, you can go and do so. Now, it does say that it must be subject to the American Recovery and Reinvestment Act of 2009, the Federal Rural Energy for America program, but that's what it has to qualify in.
Representative Hoppe.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And Mr. Crocker, so what I'm getting out of that, are you telling us that this bill doesn't do anything? There's no requirement that people live in Minnesota to take part in this?
Mr. Chairman, Representative Hoppe, the requirement in this legislation is that the project be 5 megawatts or less, and that they be subject to those federal stimulus dollars and the federal energy program. That is the requirement.
Representative Hoppe.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. So then the question would be, how does this help Minnesota? How does it help our communities?
Crocker.
Mr. Chairman, Representative Hoppe, it helps our communities incredibly because, as a practical matter, go and find the 5 megawatt and less projects. Where are they? Who does them? Who is capable of doing them within the time frame? In other words, if Minnesota is interested in receiving something north of $100 million of additional stimulus money because these projects come in the time frame of the Recovery Act,
right,
this is how to do it.
Mr.
Representative Hoppe.
Well, thank you, Mr. Chair, and I understand that, and I know that we're looking in line 1.22, we're looking at the Recovery and Reinvestment Act, but we've been talking about CBED. We had some questions about the community, and we had a number of testifiers here the other day talking about how this is going to help the local community, and this is going to help people invest, and this is going to help Minnesotans make money by investing in these projects. Are you now telling us that there's nothing in this bill that says that the people, the money that's coming has to be from Minnesotans?
Mr. Crocker?
Mr. Chairman, Representative Hoppe, as a practical matter, these projects will be in Minnesota. We're almost here being expected to engage in a catch-22. On the one hand, we can't do something because it's antitrust thing. On the other hand, now you're saying if you don't engage in the antitrust activity, why we're going to get ripped off. So we're not going to get ripped off. We are going to get these 200 megawatts of projects as a practical matter, not as a legal requirement, in Minnesota, because it is Minnesota experience, Minnesota knowledge, Minnesota investment dollars. You heard the bankers testify. They're the ones that are set up for this to happen.
Thank you, Mr. Cracker. Representative Hoppe, you want to...
I'll wrap it up,
and then I want to hear from Representative Anderson, then we're going to vote.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And Mr. Crocker, I understand it's Minnesota, 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 but you're also telling us it could be Iowa.
Okay.
There's nothing in here that says it's Minnesota, 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 other than your assurance as a practical matter.
Thank you. Thank you, Representative Hoppe. Representative Anderson, you pass it. They covered. All right. With that, Representative Zeller.
Well, Mr. Chair, I'd actually had an amendment that we didn't vote on the last committee. And I can do it as an oral amendment to reinstate on lines 1.13 the stricken language, which is at a minimal impact to customer rates. I'd offered that amendment, or I included that amendment in the last committee. And
we have it as the A9 amendment, Representative Zeller.
And
Representative Zeller's offers the A9 amendment.
And I'd actually request a roll call, Mr. Chairman, on that one as well. Representative Anzo's point in the discussion we had, if we're going to do any of these projects, this was good language going out when we did the original CBED project. I don't know why the author, based on the merits of his bill, would want to take that kind of language out otherwise, unless they're scared of it. So, Mr. Chairman, I appreciate members' support on the amendment.
Thank you, Representative Zellers. Representative Falk, it doesn't seem to, the amendment doesn't seem to do a lot. Are you comfortable with the amendment?
Well, Mr. Chair, I don't recall this being offered in the previous committee.
No, it wasn't offered, but it was in the packets in the previous committee. Do you have a copy of it?
I don't have a copy for me.
It's literally just the language.
I understand what it is. I guess the thing we already have currently in statute, it requires a bifurcated rate for CBED projects where the price is higher in the first 10 years than it is in the second 10 years. And I think that's one of the hang-ups that people have had, is that you may lock in a slightly higher price in the first 10 years, which is coming from the average MISO price, discounted at the utilities average for their cost of capital, which they file with the PUC. But it's priced 10 years out, the years 11 through 10 or 11 through 20, and the contract is locked in at a significantly lower rate. It's really a hedge against future energy prices increases, which we know are coming.
And
I'll take that as a no, Mr. Chairman.
And I appreciate the answer. Quite frankly, with respect to the Commerce Committee's purview, that language that was stricken does actually make a great deal of sense from a commerce perspective. I support the amendment. I think it's one that you all can probably live with and make work, and I'd recommend support as well. Are there other questions or concerns with respect to the amendment? You still want a roll call?
No, that's fine, Mr. Chairman.
The request for roll call is withdrawn. All in favor say aye.
Aye.
Any opposed? Seeing none, seeing one, the motion prevails. Representative Falk, anything further that you want to wrap up with respect to your bill?
No, thank you, Mr. Chair. I appreciate the committee's time, and I would ask for your support.
Okay, there was a roll call requested with respect to the bill as well. The chair then will renew his motion that House File 357, as amended, be recommended passed and be referred to the Committee on Finance with a recommended re-referral to the Committee on Energy Policy and Finance. The clerk will take the roll.
Heckman.
Aye.
Anderson.
No.
Anzels.
Aye.
Stevens.
No.
Dabney.
Aye.
Fritz.
Hoppe.
No.
Hosh. Johnson.
Aye.
Knuth.
Aye.
Lilly.
Aye.
Mullery. Murdoch.
No.
Sanders.
No.
Simon.
Aye.
Folsom.
Aye.
Tao.
Aye.
Zellers.
No.
Motion prevails 9-6. Thank you, Representative Falk.
Thank you.
And thank you to the folks that came back a second time. We apologize for making you have to do that. Whether you're proponents or opponents, we respect your time and we appreciate the opportunity to have you come back again. There are two bills remaining. They are the chair's bills, and hopefully I won't take too much of your time with them. I will move House File 1717 be recommended passed and referred to someplace really good. We're going to the general register.
Chair Atkins, I understand you have an amendment. Would you like to?
Chair, it's an office amendment to bring peace to car dealers and manufacturers. It is the A1 amendment. I appreciate your support.
Does everybody have the A1 amendment?
Yep.
Sounds good. Any questions? Seeing none, all in favor say aye.
Aye.
Those opposed? A1 adopted. We have your bill as amended before us. Chair Atkins?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And the bill does three things. There is, as I understand, an agreement between auto dealers and auto manufacturers. The dealers brought this bill to me. Frankly, a lot of them are in a world of hurt right now, and the goal of this bill is to try to make their ability to survive this difficult time a little bit easier. It does three things. They've been agreed to by the manufacturers as well. The first is that it requires successor manufacturers to offer existing dealers a franchise on similar terms as the predecessor manufacturer. Secondly, it recognizes the value of blue sky, which is something of an industry term, but that means the manufacturer will compensate the terminated dealer for the value of the franchise over and above the value of just the physical assets. And finally, it allows the dealers to add another line make in their existing facility, which has become quite an issue. In fact, it was an issue for a constituent of mine in South St. Paul. That's what it does. I'm not aware of there being opposition. I really genuinely appreciate both sides getting together to figure it out before we put it on for hearing. And with that, I'd be happy to stand for any questions or concerns.
Thank you, Chair Atkins. Hopefully we can get the folks on this committee to go back to their roots and pro-capitalist position. Any questions for the author? Anybody in the audience that would like to be heard for or against this bill? Seeing none. With that, Chair Atkins renews his motion that House File 1717 as amended be recommended to pass to the General Register. All in favor say aye.
Aye.
Those opposed? Your bill is passed, sir, with some vocal opposition. Jackin.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. With that, I would move House File 1719 be recommended pass and re-referred to the General Register. Is that the next step?
To the Committee on Public Safety and Policy Oversight. Unless Chair Mallory isn't here to pass.
No, it's okay.
Get it through.
Chair Atkins, I understand you have some amendments. Do you want to?
I do, and I appreciate this is a department bill designed to be non-controversial, and in an effort to do that, the department was kind enough to work with some folks that raised some concerns. So I have the A1 and the A3 amendments that will put it in the shape with which I'd like to proceed. The first is the A1 amendment. I will move the A1 amendment.
Chair Atkins has moved the A1 amendment. Everybody has that. Any questions? Seeing none, all in favor say aye.
Aye.
Those opposed? Amendment adopted.
Mr. Chair, I'll move the A3 amendment.
Thank you. Chair Atkins has moved the A3. Any questions? Seeing none, all in favor say aye.
Aye.
Those opposed? A3 is adopted. We have your bill as amended before us.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and members. This deals with viatical settlements, life settlements. The summary in your packet is, I think, right on the mark. As I said, is a department and technical bill. We've done our best to address any concerns that have been raised relative to any controversy. There may or may not be still things that arise, but we'll do our best to deal with those. By the way, I deeply appreciate the folks from the regarding the last bill as well as this bill. They think it's an advantage to have the chair be your author, but we make them stick around for 3.5 hours waiting for their bills to come up. So I think with that, Mr. Chair, I just stand for any questions or concerns that people have.
Thank you, Chair. Mm-hmm. Any questions up here? Anybody in the audience that'd like to be heard for or against this bill? Seeing none. With that, Chair Atkins renews his motion that House File 1719 as amended be recommended to pass and re-referred to the Committee on Public Safety Policy and Oversight. All in favor say aye.
Aye.
Those opposed? Your bill's passed, sir.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and members. I don't believe I'll just conclude from here. Thursday night or Thursday afternoon will be, might not be as heavy as tonight as far as the number of bills where we... frankly, we loaded this one up just in case we had bills that got referred to our committee at the last minute. So we may get out at a relatively earlier time, but keep you posted. Again, the only thing that I forewarn you about is we're getting bills with every passing day. As soon as we see them, we will try to get them out to members and add it to the agenda so that we don't blindside anybody. Thank you all very much.
Thank you, Chair Atkins. Members, we're adjourned.